It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly.
It is WrestleMania week. This is episode 592 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, March 31st, 2019. I am the Sala Monster. It is WrestleMania week. A lot of events coming up. Some of you crazy people I know are going to all of them or trying to. I think it would be physically impossible for you to go to all of the different events coming up this week here in the New York area. Hopefully, one of the events that you make a pit stop at is our meetup on Friday, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Hopefully I get to see you all there. But before I get to all that, I want to say thank you to everybody who has supported the YouTube channel and all the content I have stored on there. If you have subbed to the YouTube channel, The Sala Monster is the name on YouTube. We just passed 48,000 subs this week, which means we're that much closer to 50K. And we also passed 10 million views on the channel, which for a channel that doesn't have as much content going up there as other channels, I think is a pretty good milestone. That wouldn't happen without you, so thank you for that. Just to give you a quick sense of what the recording plan is, because there's so many different things going on, and it's going to be a very busy weekend for me, my plan right now is to save the WrestleMania predictions and any kind of late breaking news on the show late in the week to record on Thursday. With the idea that would go up late Thursday, early Friday, so let's say Friday morning, that would be episode 593, and that would almost exclusively be WrestleMania rundown of the card, which of course that alone will take 5.5 hours, all the predictions, and probably the number one pick in our WrestleMania shocking match outcome countdown that I've been doing now the last several weeks. So that would be the plan. Thursday or Friday that would go up. And then the next thing probably wouldn't be until Monday morning, which would be the WrestleMania review, and probably would not... Actually, that might not be until midday on Monday. Depends what time I get back since I'm going to WrestleMania. I wish there was going to be time in between for me to do thoughts on TakeOver, which is Friday night, the MSG show on Saturday. That may have to wait until Monday or Tuesday. There is no roundtable this year. Usually we do a WrestleMania roundtable with myself and Noah and Brian. We were making plans to, but between the House of Glory thing on Saturday that I'm going to be at and all the other stuff going on, it's just not going to be possible. So if you are a big fan of the roundtables, I'm sorry to burst your bubble. You're only going to get me this year. Hopefully that's enough. Keep supporting Audible. They are a great partner of the podcast. Great time of year to cash in on a book, free book, if you're going to be traveling to WrestleMania. You might want to listen to an audiobook on your flight in or if you're driving in. Use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. You can sample the service for 30 days, get one free audiobook, a lot of wrestling books. You can listen to Daniel Bryan's book on the way to WrestleMania. You can listen to Hulk Hogan. Well, I don't know why you'd want to listen to Hogan's book, but you've got Justin Roberts and Bob Holly and Chris Jericho and a ton of great books on there. So use our link for that. If you are coming to WrestleMania, if you're coming to any of the ancillary events going on this weekend, you're going to be traveling around, taking a cab, why not do a Lyft? Sign up for a Lyft account, and when you do so, use the code SALAMONSTER for your first ride, and you'll get some money off. Could be $5, could be $10, I think it depends on where you live and all that, but use the code SALAMONSTER if you're going to be traveling around this weekend, coming to our meetup. Get a few bucks off your cab ride to the event. And as far as the event on Friday, it's at the KBH, the King's Beer Hall, this Friday, April 5th, beginning at 2 p.m. Eastern. So it's like a loose start time. It'll pretty much run about 4 hours. We'll be there for 6 o'clock or so. Those people going to the Barclay Center for the NXT TakeOver show, like myself, will start to make our way over there. And 4 hours, I think, is a pretty good window to do some drinking, do some eating, get ready for the NXT show, hang out with a bunch of crazy wrestling fans. And there are drink specials, if you are interested in that. There are happy hour specials on house beers and wine, cocktails, cider, all that stuff. They'll have some of the same specials they had last summer when we were there. So if you want a frozen SmackDown margarita, you can get one of those. Frozen knockout daiquiri. You can add a house shot to any beer. It's going to be going on, so come on down. Hopefully I get to see all you crazy people on Friday. If you want to make a PayPal donation to the show, you can do so. TheSolomonster.com, right-hand side of the page, you'll see the button. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you here on this WrestleMania Week broadcast to the Stone Mountain Assassin, Adrian Mitchum II. You can check out his Facebook group. It's called The House of Kayfabe. So you can join the group and join the discussion on there. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, The Macho Messiah A.C. Smith, The Florida Freebird Brian Pacera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, The Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T., Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, The Anarchist Andrew Heller, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Danger Dan Larson, Cody the Codebreaker Tyler, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, shout out to Mama Eichert, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Laredo Kid Alberto Ortiz, Slice and Dice Stephen Chapa, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soap, Wildcat Wasib Akhtar, Trevon the Cannon Clark, Z Sheriff 14, and Define Real. Also want to give a shout out to Nicholas Phillips and Kerry A. Perry, Rad Rob, Rob Francois. I know he's listening right now. He's got his Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast. They're going to be bringing you a week's worth of original content leading into WrestleMania 35, including interviews with Ring of Honor star PCO, former WWE announcer Sean Mooney, who has his own podcast right now, and the voice of the Boston Celtics, also big wrestling fan, Sean Grand. Plus, breaking down WrestleMania, they'll have a live wrap-up for NXT TakeOver on their YouTube pre- and post-roundtables for Mania itself. See, got other people picking up the slack here. So you can subscribe on iTunes for that, or visit radturtleswrestlingpodcast.simplecast.fm. Shout out to WrestleRumble.com. They're running a live championship belt raffle today. If you are listening to this early enough, you can still enter. There's still time to win not one, but two championship belts. You've got the classic Winged Eagle, my favorite, plus any title of your choice off of WWEshop.com, priced at $429.99 or under. The drawing takes place today at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. You have until 4:45 to enter, so there's still time. It's only 10 bucks. You can walk away with two title belts, and I think it's worth it for the Winged Eagle alone, let alone a second title belt. Just go to WrestleRumble.com right now to sign up. And last plug here before we get into the news, because there's so many different things going on. I've been talking about this Kevin Nash party, the shenanigans party. I know some of you have been asking me about it. What's the deal with tickets? First of all, it's taking place at McHale's Pub following the G1 Supercard on Saturday, so it starts at 11 p.m. Al Snow, Melina, Rikishi, Val Venus, Terry Runnels, D'Lo, Tonga Kid, DJ Z, and believe me, there'll be a bunch of other people I'm not even naming who just randomly show up. There's less than a dozen tickets left, for those of you who have asked. That's it. When they're gone, they're gone. Gold VIP, that's all that's left. You can use promo code SOLOMONSTER, get 10% off your ticket. You can get them at facebook.com/PWR show, look under the events tab, or just go to bit.ly/shenanigansNYC. Koji Kitao passed away on February 10th. This according to Nikon News in Japan, Nikon Sports, but it was only revealed this week. So he died over a month ago, almost 2 months ago now. Nobody knew, I guess, until now. He was 55 years old. I did not see any cause of death revealed. He did pro wrestling. He did sumo wrestling. He did mixed martial arts. Actually, he beat former WWE star Nathan Jones in a fight once that you can find on YouTube. I just talked about Kitao not too long ago on this podcast, eerily enough. When I heard about this, I said, man, I was just talking about him within the last, I think, couple of months. I want to say it was during the mailbag segment. And I talked about his infamous match in Japan with Earthquake, John Tenta, where Kitao just shot on him. It was part, if I remember, it was part of this tour, this joint promotion between WWF and the SWS promotion at the time. This was around 1990 or so. And, or maybe 91, 90 or 91. And they had two matches, I believe. It was part of a tour. The first match went fine. This was the second match. And whatever bug crawled up Kitao's ass. I don't know what his deal was. I don't know what his problem was. He was not selling anything that Tenta did. And Tenta, he was shooting on him. Tenta shot right back on him. You know, John Tenta's not somebody to be fucked with. He himself was a legit sumo. Big guy. And so he gave it right back to him. And then after, so finally they see this match is going nowhere. They award the victory to Tenta. He puts his arms up in the air celebrating like he's the big winner. Kitao leaves the ring. He didn't take too kindly to being told, you know, hey, you know, this guy's the winner, I lost. He leaves the ring. He grabs a microphone. And he starts shouting that wrestling is fake. He's going on this, in Japanese, he's going on this diatribe that wrestling is fake. Other wrestlers rush over, almost like tackle him, trying to pull the microphone out of his hand. He did Ronda Rousey before Ronda ever did. So then he got fired for that. He does have the distinction of having a WrestleMania win over Demolition at WrestleMania 7. It was part of that working agreement. It was Kitao and Tenryu. They beat Smash and Crush, which is just a horrible way for Demolition's run to come to an end. I mean, they may have wrestled after that. That was really their last big match, was WrestleMania 7. And it was like a 4-minute loss to this random pairing of these two Japanese guys that nobody, you know, none of the WWE fans in the building probably even knew who they were. I mean, Tenryu was a big name, but it was just such a random thing, and for Demolition to go out that way, I guess it shouldn't be shocking they haven't been put into the Hall of Fame yet, because, you know, these two guys have been treated like shit pretty much ever since then. I know Axe had some kind of lawsuit going for the rights, I think, to the Demolition name, which I believe was resolved many years ago, and so that probably left some bad blood. Then they added their names to the concussion lawsuit a few years ago, but there was still this huge gap in between where there could have been sort of a reconciliation or a Hall of Fame induction, and even before the concussion stuff, it just never happened. For whatever reason, Demolition for all these years has just been, as a team, right? They've been on their shit list. I think Repo Man was in the gimmick battle royal, at least at WrestleMania. I don't know, maybe there's no heat there. But anyway, that's one of those kind of random things that, if you're a WWF fan, you probably know Kitao's name, kind of a random trivia note there. And, yeah, they beat Demolition so bad that that same year they morphed into Repo Men and Kona Crush. That's how badly they got beaten. So, I don't know what happened there, but yeah, 55 is very young for anyone to leave us. One of the true last holy grails of wrestling has finally been unearthed. Now, over the years, you may have heard me on this podcast mention the match between Bret Hart and a gentleman by the name of Tom McGee from 1986. Tom McGee, who looks, yes, does look very much like Kenny Omega. If Kenny Omega took Doc Brown's DeLorean back to 1986, he also, like Omega, happens to be a native of Winnipeg, which is kind of interesting. He was a Canadian powerlifter. He turned into a pro wrestler, had a great look. You know, if you look at the guy, he looked like $1 million. He looked like he was etched from granite, had this long blonde hair, very athletic. He could do backflips and things that a lot of people, at least in that company at the time, weren't doing. Kind of like Lanny Poffo in a way. Lanny Poffo, years before he ever became the genius, was Leaping Lanny in the mid-80s in WWF, and he was doing moonsaults and backflips and all types of you know, aerial moves that nobody was doing in that company then, because it was the land of the giants and the monsters. You can see Don Morocco doing a moonsault off the top rope. I'd like to find that tape, right? That just didn't happen. So he was a very athletic guy. Now, eventually he got signed by WWE, and he wrestled Bret Hart at a Wrestling Challenge taping in Rochester, New York. Challenge had just premiered in September of 86, so the month before, maybe not even a full month before this match, Challenge had just premiered on television. The match never aired. It never aired, and it's only been seen by a handful of people at most, one of whom is Bret himself. WWE had given Bret, by his request, a copy of the match on VHS many years ago. He asked for it. And about a decade ago, Bret was looking to convert his, what I'm sure is a vast VHS collection of tapes, to DVD. And so enter this woman, Mary Kate Anthony, who shared a mutual friend with Brett, this lady, Marcy Engelstein. Marcy was Brett's longtime assistant for many years. When Brett was active on his website, this is going back many years now, Marcy, I remember being the one who would post messages on the site, sometimes on behalf of Brett. So that's how I knew the name Marcy Engelstein. But apparently she was friends with this other woman, Mary Kate. That was the connection. And for whatever reason, Mary ended up with Brett's collection. I think she even went up to Calgary to collect all these VHS tapes. And she was going to help convert them for Brett to DVD. And she, I don't know if she just still has all of the tapes and just sent the DVDs back to Brett, I assume. She's had this tape in her possession, not knowing the significance of it, for a decade. She came across it the other day, and it had a sticker on it, Bret Hart versus Tom McGee, dated September 19, 1989, which sounded like it might not be the match, it might be the rematch. They had a rematch, the two of them did, in 89, although apparently it was in May, not September of 89. That also did not air on TV. Thing is, there was no television taping at all on September 19, 1989. So the sticker was inaccurate. The sticker was wrong. That gave people hope. Well, the sticker's wrong. Maybe it was just mislabeled. Maybe it was the date that Brett was given the VHS. I don't know. So the woman was waiting for a VCR, because who the fuck has a VCR sitting around anymore? I mean, I do, but look, I'm a child of the 80s. Of course, I'm going to keep my VCR. So she's waiting for a VCR. She gets it on Friday. VCR gets shipped to her on Friday. And when she pops the tape in, sure enough, it is the original match from 1986. Can you imagine if that fucking VCR ate that tape? The coronary that people would have had. I think this woman would have gotten death threats. I mean, look, I think this is a cool story, but there are people, my God, in the last few days, you would think that it was just the end-all be-all of their lives. I think if that tape was accidentally eaten by that machine, this woman would have needed 24/7 round-the-clock police protection. That's how crazy people have gotten over this. So she said that she would be posting a clip from the match. She's not going to upload it right now, she says, for legal reasons. So anybody waiting for the match to go up on YouTube or Dailymotion, it's not happening. I don't know what her plans are for the tape. She did post a short GIF, no audio or anything, just a short GIF on Twitter of McGee reversing Brett into the corner, Brett taking his chest first bump into the corner that he would become very much known for. And then it shows McGee just standing there. So Brett hits the corner, right? He falls down. And McGee, it's like he doesn't know what to do. It's like he has two left feet. He's standing there. He's doing these awkward poses. This guy was so bad. He was so insanely horrible. And they must have originally planned for this match to air on television, because according to her, she watched it. It has commentary from Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan. In fact, there's a funny moment where he's doing moves, McGee is, and Monsoon makes some comment to the effect of, you know, this won't be the last time we see this youngster here in WWF. And then apparently he botches something, and Bobby Heenan just goes, I hope not. As in, like, I hope we don't see much of this guy in the future. He was a prophet, Bobby Heenan was. So it had commentary. Clearly, it was at one time, the idea was that it would air on television, and it just didn't. Now, she claims that she talked to two different office employees at WWE. They've told her personally they don't have the tape. They've looked for it over the years. People have looked for it. They don't have it. I cannot believe that WWE would just have given one of their master tapes away without having some kind of a backup. That they just gave Brett their only copy. I find this impossible to believe. Maybe she was told that. Maybe they genuinely tried looking for it and it's not labeled properly. It's lost in the vault somewhere. That I think is maybe the more likely scenario. But I'm hoping that this whole thing lights a fire under their asses and finally gets them to find it and upload it as a hidden gem on the network. They've uploaded some pretty rare things on the network in the hidden gem section. And this would be perfect for something like that. Or if they can't find it, let them buy it from her. Let them buy it from her and add it back to their collection, and then they can upload it. You know, I didn't even recognize Mary's name at first. It took me a while. I heard the name, oh, Mary Kate. Who is this woman? Why would she have Brett's tapes and all this? But she used to shoot photos. I remember where I knew her from. she used to shoot photos at Ring of Honor shows when I first started going to their New York shows in 2006. She may have actually even taken photos from some of the ECW shows back in the mid to late 90s. But yeah, if you remember a redheaded female photographer at any of those ROH shows, that was her. So she's not just a random fan, she's, you know, done photography and she's worked in different aspects of the business. So anyway, that's the connection there. So what's so special about this damn match, right? There's probably people listening to this going, I can't believe you're talking about a match, a random, probably crappy match at that, from 1986. What is the significance of this match? Why is everybody freaking out? Wrestlers too. Tyson Kidd was freaking out about this. Lance Storm, Scott Dawson of The Revival. He's a huge Bret Hart mark. He was freaking out about it. As the story goes, Vince McMahon took one look at this Tom McGee guy, and he saw dollar signs. And he wanted to test him to see how good he was. So, what do you do when you want to put somebody to the test? You put them in the ring with one of your best people. He decided, even in 86, Vince obviously had a lot of respect for Bret and his skills. And so he put him in the ring with Bret. Bret made him look so good in this match that Vince McMahon backstage watching on the monitor was gushing about how he just found his next world champion. Now, this is at a time when Hulk Hogan was at his peak of popularity. I would argue 86. You want to talk about the apex of Hogan's popularity during his first run as champion. It's not 87, not the Andre Slam. It's 86. So Hogan's at his peak of popularity in 86. And at that time, Vince is thinking, I found my next champion. He's looking ahead already to the next guy to replace Hogan. So he sees McGee, and he obviously wants to see him wrestle other people as well. The problem is when McGee gets in the ring in the days and weeks that followed with other people, not named Bret Hart, he was sorely disappointed because this guy looked like shit. He didn't look nearly as good as he did in the match with Bret. In fact, he sucked. He was no good. And it's a credit to Bret that he managed to convince Vince that this guy was going to be the heir apparent. In his book, Bret Hart talks about it. He says, yeah, he was appalled when Chief J. Strongbow, who was working as an agent backstage, came over to him and told him that he was going to work McGee at the taping that night and that Vince wanted McGee to go over. Bret was just appalled. And he went right to Vince's office and Vince said, look, you're the only one I can trust to get this guy over and show me if I can make money with him. And that, of course, you know, that soothed Bret's ego. He wasn't happy about it, but he was like, well, in that case, I'll do my best. And he said McGee did exactly as he was told. He told Tom, this is what we're going to do. Tell me your two or three biggest moves and boom, boom, boom. This is what we'll do. He said McGee followed it right down to a T. And he said he was awful. He said he did his best to make him look good, but he could tell just being in the ring with him that this guy was the shits. So they come back through the curtain. Vince is giddy, right, that he just found his next champion. Nobody's going over to Bret. They're all going over to Tom. Oh, you know, that was a great match. And they're just gushing over this guy. Now, after watching it, the only thing Mary said about the match after watching it herself is that it proves that Bret's catchphrase is true, that he carried McGee the entire way through. It was all Bret. It even includes a post-match promo with Ken Resnick apparently interviewing Tom McGee. I have to see this. This thing has been built up so much. I don't see how it can be anything but a disappointment, but I still want to see it. Like, I know for a fact that if this thing ever does leak on Daily Motion, or if WWE ever puts it out finally themselves, like, people are going to watch this after it's been built up for so many years, and they're just going to watch it, and probably 10 minutes later, they're going to be like, that's it? Like, I guarantee you that's going to be the reaction. But it's just such a rare thing that that's what happens, right? These things get built up and built up, and it can't possibly live up to expectations. So anyway, if it ever gets posted, I promise you one thing. I will review that match here on the podcast. You have my word. If it ever does finally leak, I guess the next thing to chase after now would be that Snake Pit segment from 86. Everything's from 86. There was a Snake Pit segment with Jake and Hogan, the one where Jake gave Hogan a DDT, and the crowd cheered. That was not the reaction that they were going for. See, these days we're used to it, right? The babyface that they're shoving down people's throats invariably will get booed. It'll happen with Becky. It's going to happen with... It's going to continue to happen for years to come. people are very fickle, and they just, they like what they like, and sometimes the cool heel is the cool guy to cheer for. And Jake was fucking cool, man, back then. He was the bad guy, but people liked him. So apparently this was going to air on television. They were going to have a program. I don't know if it was going to be on TV or just live events. But when he DDT'd Hogan and the place cheered, the place popped. I'm sure Hogan freaked, Vince freaked, and they abandoned their plans to do anything with Hogan and Jake. Now you can search around online and you can find there's a couple of different snake pits with Hogan. None of them are that one from 86, though. The one in question, where the DDT happened. That one has, I don't think it's ever aired on television. If it did, it aired locally in whatever market it was, that it was taped, and that was it. I guess that's the next Holy Grail. That's the next hidden gem now that people have to look for. You know, McGee was in the news last year. For those of you asking what the hell ever happened to Tom McGee, because he was in wrestling for about 4 or 5 years, and then he vanished. He wrestled in Japan a little bit. He did some other promotions. And by 1990 or so, he had left wrestling completely. But he was in the news last year. He got the shit beaten out of him by six punk kids who beat him up in an argument over a parking spot outside of his home. I think he still lives up in Canada. He was like the neighborhood watchdog. Everybody knew him, and he's a nice guy. And he came outside. I don't know if they were like, if the kids were loitering or graffitiing. I don't know what they were doing. They were doing something they shouldn't have been doing. And he came outside and they broke his jaw. They broke his eye socket, his face. If you look at the picture of him, his face looks all mangled. If the neighbors didn't come outside and chase those kids away, they would have killed him. And I haven't heard any updates. This was in May of last year. That wasn't even a year ago. He's probably still recovering from his injuries. Hopefully he's doing okay. We now know the full rundown for the sold-out Ring of Honor New Japan G1 Supercard from Madison Square Garden, which is coming up this Saturday. It airs live on New Japan World. It airs live on Honor Club, which is Ring of Honor service. I will be there live. And like I said, within a few days, I don't know the exact day, but in the days that follow, I will do a review on the podcast of the show. It'll also be airing on a delay for those of you who want to wait and watch it on TV. It is going to be airing as a two-part special, two straight weeks, on Access Television, Friday, April 12th, and then the second half of it, I guess, will air on Friday the 19th, both at 8 p.m. Eastern. For those of you who don't mind waiting a few weeks, of course, you can wait and watch it on TV. This is a historic show. This is the first non-McMahon wrestling show held inside Madison Square Garden since 1960. WWE has been running the Barclays Center way more often because it's cheaper and it's easier to load their equipment in and out of Barclays than it is at MSG. It's more of a pain in the ass to do it at MSG. Basically, you know, if you want to look at it like this, both sides decided to see other people. They can still be fuck buddies, get together from time to time, but WWE's new love is the Barclays Center, and MSG is free to date whoever it wants. This weekend, it's Ring of Honor and New Japan Pro Wrestling, a menage a trois. In September, it may be AAA running its first show ever at Madison Square Garden. AAA is actually holding a press conference this Thursday at MSG to make a very special announcement. Now, why would they be hosting a press conference at Madison Square Garden? I wonder. Conan is going to be there. Pentagon is going to be there. Phoenix, Daga, I think Aerostar, bunch of lucha talents are going to be there. The press advisory for the event says only that the promotion is coming to the United States in September. So you put two and two together, it's not hard to figure out what the announcement is going to be. They already had a date reserved to run the garden for the first time last September. They opted to delay it. I guess they weren't ready for, you know, such a big show just yet. It is interesting to note, you know, WWE's touring schedule for the rest of the year, it leaked this week in a court filing. They have dates reserved for September 10th and 11th at Madison Square Garden. That's a Monday and a Tuesday. So it looks like Raw and SmackDown are headed to MSG for the first time in 10 years. That was the Raw show that I was at, that Vince McMahon, he confronted Rowdy Piper. Kofi Kingston hit the boom drop on Randy Orton in the crowd. That all happened on that Raw show in, I want to say it was November of 09. And by the way, those of you who miss seeing that little short aisleway, because MSG kind of had a very unique look. Not every Raw show at MSG had that look. Some of them had just the big Titantron on the ramp. like the night Austin stunned Vince for the first time. That, you know, was your basic Raw is War kind of look. But this last Raw show at the Garden had the little short aisle way. That's all gone. They renovated the Garden, unfortunately. Everything I feel like that gave this building its own personality has just been stripped away. So that little short aisle way is no more, so it'll just look like every other show. But yeah, it's been 10 years since they've run a Raw show at Madison Square Garden. The last pay-per-view that they had at MSG, I believe, was The Rock's big return to the ring after 8 years at the Survivor Series in 2011. Yeah, so it appears that somebody else is now encroaching on their territory. That may have scared WWE into tiptoeing their way back to the Garden. But as far as this Ring of Honor show, again, this is a historic show. You don't have to be a fan of the product to be able to admit that. I have my own memories of waiting in line outside the New Yorker Hotel, which is right around the corner from the Manhattan Center. And that was the very first Ring of Honor show I ever went to. It was at the New Yorker Hotel in the grand, in the ballroom they had there. I remember Jimmy Rave was on the show, and the big gimmick was people would throw toilet paper at Jimmy Rave, and he would throw it right back out into the crowd. And I'm sure the management there at the hotel was not happy that this giant, God only knows how much it cost, chandelier was above the ring. And actually, when guys were doing moves off the top rope, they had to be careful not to hit the chandelier. But when people were throwing the toilet paper at Jimmy Rave, a lot of it got caught up in the chandelier. So I remember that, and I remember the main event that night was a three-way with Bryan Danielson, Samoa Joe, and Kenta. And I had a fourth row ringside seat for that. So I have all these great memories of just waiting in line outside. And then when they moved out of there and they were starting to do shows in the Manhattan Center, up in the Grand Ballroom, where WWE first came when they were doing Monday Night Raw back in 93, I'd be standing outside. The line would just be wrapped around the block, snaked around the block, waiting to get in. And you just turn around and there in the shadows a block away is Madison Square Garden. And, you know, you just kind of look at it and go, you think to yourself, could this promotion run a show there? And, of course, the answer was always no. At that time, anyway, 2006, 2007, the idea of Ring of Honor running the Garden was just pure fantasy. But you'd be standing there with MSG behind you, and it was just sort of like, it's almost like it was looking over you, it was lording over you. Like, oh, you guys are relegated to this building here. You'll never be in this one. You'll never be big enough to be in this building over here. And here we are now. The fact that they're running the Garden is a pretty neat thing. They have the benefit, of course, of running WrestleMania weekend and piggybacking off of WrestleMania when thousands of wrestling fans are descending upon New York City. Can they sell out the Garden a second time on a non-WrestleMania weekend? That remains to be seen. That's going to be a lot more difficult. That's going to be a lot tougher without, especially without the New Japan tie-in. And we have to talk about that too, because that, as much as anything, I think has to do with the success of the show and the tickets that they've already sold. Because me personally, I'm going to this show as much for New Japan as I am Ring of Honor, probably even more so than Ring of Honor. You know, WWE moved their NXT TakeOver show from Saturday to Friday night to accommodate those fans who wanted to attend both shows. They weren't worried. I don't think it was a case where they were worried about selling tickets, because both shows were going to sell out no matter what. Or at least NXT was going to sell out no matter what. I believe Triple H when he says, when somebody asked him about this a few months ago, and he said, we moved it to accommodate the fans. I thought that was a very magnanimous move on their part. Especially as somebody who had tickets to go to the MSG show, I was going to be super pissed if I couldn't go to the NXT one. Now I get to go to both. And that's a great thing for the fans. Now, this is a show that when people initially bought tickets, they thought this show was going to have the members of the Elite. They thought Kenny Omega was going to be on the show. They thought the Young Bucks were going to be on the show. But with the announcement of All Elite Wrestling, that prevented that from happening. Or did it? I mean, who's to say that we don't get a surprise appearance or two? I still believe AEW is ultimately going to end up working with New Japan, at least, in some capacity. But they are not scheduled to be on this show. And even without them, you look at the lineup on paper for the show, it is a really strong card on paper. And the relationship, I don't think, can be overstated between Ring of Honor and New Japan, because without it, I don't think Ring of Honor gets into Madison Square Garden. Forget, do they sell out or do they not sell out? I don't think this show happens without the tie-in with New Japan and bringing in talent like Okada and Tanahashi and Ibushi. I don't think this show happens. Now, at the same time, New Japan is trying to expand into the U.S. market more, so it benefits them to have a working relationship with a promotion like Ring of Honor and to get their talent into a building for the first time, like Madison Square Garden. You got a guy like Jushin Thunder Liger, who's done everything there is to do in this business. He's about to retire next year, and all he wants to do is put me on the card at MSG. I want to be able to say that I wrestled at MSG for the first time. And he will be. Even to him, this is a big deal. For New Japan to have their guys headlining or co-headlining a show at Madison Square Garden in front of a sold-out crowd, that's a big deal to them. So I do think the relationship has benefited Ring of Honor more. But it is a mutually beneficial partnership that these two companies have together. We'll see if it continues beyond this show. You know, AEW is going to start making waves soon as we get closer to their first event. We'll see if this relationship continues. You know, I like it when companies come together and they work together. I'd love to see all three work together, Ring of Honor, New Japan, and AEW, and have some kind of a talent exchange. But if AEW gets television, that's probably not going to happen. I don't know how interested Sinclair would be in working with them at that point once they get TV. But the start time for the card has been bumped up to 6:15 p.m., so your ticket probably says something different. I only read about this last week. Apparently now the show is starting earlier. 6:15 start with a Stardom tag team match, a women's tag team dark match that will not air. That will follow, or following that rather, is going to be a 30-person Honor Rumble. That starts at 6:30, or at least entrances start at 6:30. Jushin Thunder Liger is the first name announced for it. He gets his chance to wrestle inside Madison Square Garden for the first time, and probably the only time in his career. I hope he wins the entire thing. Although these Honor Rumbles in the past, I know they've been for a shot, I think typically at the Ring of Honor World title. I don't think Liger is getting a shot at the Ring of Honor World title. So I'll say this, if it's for a title shot, I think somebody else wins it. And who that is, I don't know, because I don't know all the names of the people in the match. But if it's not for a title shot, I'm picking Jushin Thunder Liger to win the Battle Royal. We've got title for title. This is the match that's going to open the show at 7:30. This is opening the main card at 7:30. Champion against champion, title for title. The never open weight champion Will Ospreay against Ring of Honor TV champion Jeff Cobb. This will be their first ever one-on-one match against each other. Cobb threw down the gauntlet after his win at the ROH 17th anniversary show. He's a very athletic big guy. If you watch Lucha Underground, you know, you saw what he can do as the Monster Matanza. He's not a tall guy, but he's just this big, strong guy who can throw people around like they're nothing. Ospreay, he once held the ROH TV title that Cobb now has. He held it for all of 48 hours before dropping it. He beat Kota Ibushi at Wrestle Kingdom in January to win the Never Openweight title. So one man is going to leave with two belts, and I think that man is Jeff Cobb. I'm picking him to win. He is signed to Ring of Honor, but he does still work New Japan shows. Ospreay has only appeared once in Ring of Honor, I believe in the last 6 months, 8 months. That was back in the fall when he challenged Jay Lethal unsuccessfully for the Ring of Honor World title. So I'm picking Jeff Cobb to win both belts, or to walk out with both belts. We've got Mayu Iwatani defending her Women of Honor World title against Kelly Klein, the former champion. Iwatani won the title from her last month and then beat her again in the rematch at the ROH 17th anniversary show. That match was a bit rough, and according to The Observer, the reason why is Iwatani was kicking Kelly Klein very hard. And so Kelly Klein decided to reciprocate. She paid her back with a hard shot to the face. And after the match was over, they brought the two of them together in the back to sort of hash things out, talk things out. Everything, I think, now is cool. I think Kelly Klein gets the belt back here. She seems to be the female talent that Ring of Honor is sort of grooming for greatness and building things around. And I think MSG would be a big place for her to get her belt back. And so I think she does. We've got Roosh taking on Dalton Castle. Castle struggled as the Ring of Honor champion. He was hampered by a bad back. He issued the challenge to Rush at the 17th anniversary show. He was on commentary for the match between Rush and Bandido. Rush is undefeated since coming to Ring of Honor. Dalton Castle has yet to win a match so far this year. He is the opposite of whatever undefeated is. This would be a good spot for him to get back on the winning track, but I don't think he will. I think the goal here is to build up Rush, and I think he picks up the win. We've got Bully Ray issuing an open challenge to a New York City street fight. He issued the challenge to any wrestler in either Ring of Honor or New Japan. When he laid down the challenge, he looked into the camera. He said, "You know who I'm talking about. I know you're watching, and I know it's eating you alive that I can get the better of you. I'll see you in the garden, Punk." And no, it's not CM Punk. And I hope they don't go the nostalgia route and just bring in an old ECW name, like a Sandman or a Sabu, or, I mean, Rob Van Dam would probably get a big pop, but I would rather they not go down nostalgia road, a road that has been traveled many, many, many times in wrestling. And instead, I would love to see Minoru Suzuki. Since he opened it up to Ring of Honor or New Japan, guys, I would love to see Minoru Suzuki, who does not currently have a match on this show unless they stick him in the Rumble. I'd love to see him come out. Here's a guy who does not take any shit from anybody. He's not going to take any shit from Bully Ray. And they just have this wild, crazy brawl. I actually think Ishii. I think Tomohiro Ishii would not be a bad choice either. But of the two, I would go with Suzuki. Because again, I don't see his name on the card right now. I know he's in town this weekend. He's fighting Josh Barnett. Josh Barnett is doing this Bloodsport show on Thursday. And he's going to be wrestling Josh Barnett or fighting Josh Barnett there. And then on Friday, there's a Rev Pro show, which I would totally go to if I wasn't hosting my own meetup at the same time. I picked that date long before Rev Pro even announced they were doing a show, so I'm kind of pissed about that. But Suzuki is teaming up with Zack Sabre Jr. on that show against Will Ospreay and Hiroshi Tanahashi. So Minoru Suzuki is going to be in town. He is going to be in New York this weekend, so everybody better be on their best behavior. IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion Taiji Ishimori defends his title in a triple threat match against CMLL World Lightweight Champion Dragon Lee and Bandido, who had a lot of suitors. He had a lot of interest from a lot of different places, including WWE. They wanted to sign this guy. In the end, Ring of Honor won the bidding contest. This was a big story at the time because it's not often the WWE gets outbid. And this was definitely somebody they wanted. I guess they just didn't want him bad enough. And Bandido signed with Ring of Honor. These are three of the hottest junior heavyweights in the world right now. I think Ishimori is going to retain his title and win. But this could be a show stealer with these three in the ring. We have another title for title match, the second one on this card. This is the IWGP Tag Team Champions, the Gorillas of Destiny, Tama Tonga and Tangaloa, against the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions, PCO and Brody King. PCO defending the tag team titles in Madison Square Garden 25 years, almost to the day. Not quite, but almost. 25 years after defending the WWF Tag Team titles at WrestleMania in the same building against Men on a Mission. This was supposed to originally just be two-on-two, title for title. They've now added two more teams to make it a fatal four-way. The Briscoes and Evil and Sonata are going to be in the match as well. Sonata is coming off a very impressive run in the New Japan Cup, where he went all the way to the finals against Okada before he lost. I'm not sure how the rules are going to work now. If, let's say, the Briscoes pin the Gorillas of Destiny, does that mean they win both titles, or does that mean they win just the IWGP tag team titles? I assume it would be both. This is kind of the issue in talking, you know, when you think about the women's match at WrestleMania that I'll get into later. I see all these things, oh, it's going to be winner take all, and, you know, but if Becky pins Ronda, she'll win the Raw title, but not the SmackDown title. I'm like, hey, bozo, that's not winner take all. There's a lot of confusion over what these stipulations mean. And so here it's not entirely clear. I have to assume that it would be both belts. Whoever you pin, you win both sets of belts. Since it's not an elimination match, I'm just going to assume the first fall wins you both sets of belts. And if that's the case, I'm going to pick the Gorillas of Destiny. I think they walk out with both sets of belts. We've got Zack Sabre Jr. defending his RevPro British Heavyweight title against the ace of New Japan, Hiroshi Tanahashi. We've got a RevPro title being defended inside Madison Square Garden. The fact that that's even happening is pretty wild. Sabre lost to Tanahashi in the New Japan Cup this year. This is after Sabre beat Tanahashi in the finals of the tournament last year. He won the cup by beating Tanahashi. That was in 2018. In 2019, he didn't have as much luck. I'm going to go with Sabre on this one. I don't think he loses twice in a row to Tanahashi, and I don't think Tanahashi wins the RevPro title. You know, their last match was very, in the cup, was very holds-based, very sort of mat-oriented. I know that's not a style for everybody to just watch 20 or 30 minutes of mat holds and, you know, psychology and working down a body part and all that, but these guys are very good at that. Tanahashi is one of the greatest of all time, and Sabre is, he's great. I mean, I think in front of this crowd, another match like the one they just had recently, I think it would go over just fine. I'm picking Sabre to retain. I think this crowd, by the way, I'm hoping that the people buying, assuming that the people for the most part buying tickets to this show are the hardcores, they realize the importance of this show. I hope they're loud all night long. You know, we're sitting up in the nosebleeds. We don't have exactly great seats for this show, but hopefully whether you're in the nosebleeds or you're in the front row, hopefully people make a lot of noise. Because this show, you know, this could be it. This could be the only time that they're ever packing in this building like this. I think, hopefully, that given the audience, hopefully they'll be loud for pretty much every match. We've got another rematch from the New Japan Cup. Kota Ibushi challenging Tetsuya Naito for Naito's IWGP Intercontinental title. Ibushi beat Naito in their recent match, one of the best matches of the entire tournament. I think Naito needs this more than Ibushi does. I'm picking Naito to retain. We've got Ring of Honor World Champion Jay Lethal defending his title in a triple threat ladder match against Matt Taven, who wrestled Lethal to a 60-minute draw in the 17th anniversary pay-per-view a few weeks ago. And Marty Scurll, who earned the right to challenge for the title by winning the Survival of the Fittest tournament in November. Triple threat ladder match, Madison Square Garden, world title on the line. These guys are going to hopefully not kill themselves. Should be a great match. I'm picking Marty Scurll. Do I think he's going to AEW at some point? Yes, I do. Absolutely. But not anytime soon. I think people have this idea in their heads that in the next month or two his contract is up and he's going to be a double or nothing. That's not my understanding. I don't believe that's the case. I see no harm in putting the title on him and giving him, even if it's just for a few months, giving him a run with the belt. So I think this is Marty Scurll's moment. I think he wins the championship here. And then in my opinion, the main event, the real main event of this show, which is Jay White defending his IWGP heavyweight title, being defended, by the way, for the first time ever inside Madison Square Garden against the winner of the 2019 New Japan Cup, the Rainmaker, Kazuchika Okada. Okada at MSG is a big deal. One of the reasons I even bought a ticket in the first place. I've seen him at like baseball stadiums in Brooklyn and stuff. It's not like I've never seen him live, but hopefully they do the whole Rainmaker entrance at the Garden with Okada dollars falling from the ceiling, and I just think that would be a cool sight. He's the best in the world. I know some people would disagree with that. Some people would say it's somebody outside of New Japan. Some people might say it's Kenny Omega. Some people might say it's Nia Jax. But Okada is the best in the world and has been for a few years now. My opinion, of course, but you're not going to change my mind. He belongs in the main event. Jay White probably is not the opponent that most people envisioned as Okada's MSG opponent, but they're doing their damnedest to build a new star. And this is one way to do that, especially with all the guys they've lost. They lost the Bucks, they lost Omega, they lost Cody, they lost Hangman Page. You know, collectively, that's a lot of talent to lose all at once. But they've gone through periods like this before. Remember, AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, Carl Anderson, Luke Gallows, they all disappeared all at once. That was a big blow to New Japan. And what did they do? They pushed Kenny Omega. They strapped the rocket to him and they pushed him to the very top. Now, Omega is a charismatic guy. He's more charismatic than Jay White. But this is basically just a repeat of what we've seen them do before. All right, well, we lost a bunch of guys. That sucks. So what are we going to do? Fucking cry? No. Pick the next guy to build around and give him the big push and see what happens. That's what they're doing right now with Jay White. I know a lot of people aren't sold on him. Maybe in time they will be. Maybe they won't be. But what are they going to do here at the Garden, right? Well, Jay White has made a point to point out the fact that he is 2-0 in singles matches against Okada. Okada is 0-2 against Jay White. Jay White beat Okada in last year's G1. He beat him again at Wrestle Kingdom in January. Beating Okada 3 straight times would make a statement, but I'm pulling for the Okada win to close out the show. A show that, again, looks pretty damn great even without the elite guys on board. So I think Okada's winning the championship here. I think he's winning the belt back here at Madison Square Garden. I think they've put together a lineup that could steal the entire weekend. NXT is going to be tough competition the night before. They go first. But if you're like me and you've got tickets to both shows, look, you know, you get to enjoy the best of both worlds. It's better than 8 hours of WrestleMania. You know what? I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully the show does well enough where maybe they can bring it back. But it looks like Madison Square Garden going forward might be a wrestling hotbed for promotions other than just WWE. And that's a good thing. We had 3 different retirements this week. 2 from the sports world that could impact WWE. And all of which are going to end up being total bullshit. We start with Rob Gronkowski. Rob Gronkowski of the New England Patriots, one of Mojo Rawley's best friends, announced his retirement from football at the age of 29. Mojo called him the greatest to ever play the tight end position in the NFL. I will leave that for all of the NFL experts out there to debate. That is not a debate I am equipped to have, but I would be curious if you guys would agree with that or not. Certainly, he's got to be one of the best. He is a 3-time Super Bowl champion. Huge wrestling fan. He even got physical during the Andre Battle Royal a couple of years ago in Orlando. Jinder Mahal splashed a drink in his face. He hopped the barricade and somebody forgot to clue in one of the security guards. She rushes over. She shoves Gronkowski back. Gronkowski, if you go back and watch it, he's basically looking at this woman like, what the fuck are you doing? And she was not letting him go anywhere near the ring until finally the referees come over. They're trying to smarten this woman up like, he's part of the show here. And then it was okay to let him go. But he got in the ring and he tackled down Jinder Mahal and he helped Mojo win the Battle Royal. And what a big win for Mojo it was. It turned his career around, didn't it? Now Mojo talks to himself in the mirror. He's the happiest guy in the world right now that Gronkowski retired, right? You gotta think that Mojo, nobody was happier than Mojo to find out that Gronkowski had retired. Please, please come to WWE. I need you. They have me talking to a mirror every week. Now, there's no word on what Gronkowski plans to do other than just party it up and live life. He'll be loving life like Michelle McCool when she first debuted. Now, just last month, Triple H said that the door is open for Gronkowski to come in, and if he wants to pursue a WWE career, they'll welcome him with open arms. Already his agent is talking, well, you know, in a year, maybe he'll come back and he'll play football. Already he's sort of thinking to the future, like, yeah, this retirement may not be entirely on the up and up. But Gronkowski's been plagued by back problems over the years, going back to his college days. He had surgery in college. If he was serious about this, anything other than a limited part-time deal, like a Brock Lesnar type deal, I think people are just kidding themselves about him signing a contract with WWE. I think that they need to temper those expectations. But Leo Rush, he name-dropped Gronkowski on Monday night. They were in Boston. He was cutting a promo on Finn Balor, and he said, you're going to be forced to leave like a beaten, broken, hot piece of garbage like Rob Gronkowski. That sounds like the setup to me for a spot at WrestleMania where Finn is probably having to fight off Leo on the outside. It's 2-1. He's going to get screwed again. And Gronkowski makes kind of the save for him like he did in Orlando. Comes in to save the day, takes out Leo Rush. helps Finn Balor win back the Intercontinental title. Not unlike the late Walter Payton giving Razor Ramon the assist to win back the IC title at SummerSlam back in 94. In fact, unless they announce the Demon this week on television, I know that you can see the Demon persona is in some of the advertising for WrestleMania this year. We might get a sense this week if we're going to see the Demon character, but if not, I mean, look, I think the Demon outdoors in daylight is kind of a waste. It was very weird to see The Undertaker come out in the daylight hours, WrestleMania 31, that one year. I wonder, the Wembley Stadium show, SummerSlam in 92, when he came out for the match with Kamala. Was it still daylight outside? I don't think it was. I'm pretty sure it was nighttime by that point in the night. But anyway, I don't know. The Demon outdoors in the daylight, and he needs outside help from Rob Gronkowski. If there was going to be an assist from somebody like that, I think it would be a waste of the Demon persona. If that's the plan, I would say better to hold it off for another big show like SummerSlam. You could bring out the Demon then. But do I expect that Gronkowski is done playing football? Not a chance. So that's bullshit retirement number one. Bullshit retirement number two goes to Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor also announced his retirement this week from mixed martial arts. That's a great way, by the way, to deflect from the rape accusation that just so happened to go public later that same day. The accusation, it dates back to an incident that happened in December. He was arrested in Ireland in January. That's where it happened. Allegedly it happened. But very quietly, he was arrested. Nobody knew. The laws over there are very different and a lot stricter than they are here in this country when it comes to not exposing the identity of somebody in a case like this unless it's been proven that they've committed the crime. Here, everything leaks and everybody knows everything. In Ireland, apparently, it's illegal to reveal someone's identity in that situation. So he was arrested and questioned, and then I guess he wasn't charged. He was released. Nobody knew. Although the investigation continued, and, you know, look, maybe it has no merit. Maybe it's somebody looking for a quick payday. It is said to be a credible accusation. Maybe they just find that there's not enough evidence to charge him and this goes away. But boy, is that an awfully convenient way by retiring out of nowhere to get ahead of some really bad press. At 1 o'clock in the morning, by the way, Eastern time, a random tweet, I am now retired. Just like that, out of nowhere. You don't think he knew this was coming down? The same day that this story breaks, later that same day? Come on. Don't be naive. He's another one whose name has been floated as a WWE possibility. The last time he tweeted out his retirement was 3 years ago. And he was back fighting, I think, a few months later? So I would be skeptical anyway about this. But with this news, I mean, WWE is not going to touch this guy with a 10-foot pole. The mere stench of an accusation against Enzo, and he was gone. Now, I get the sense they didn't like him anyway, and they were just looking for a reason to get rid of him. But still, the mere stench of an accusation similar to this against Enzo Amore, and that was it. His career was over. But will he ever fight again? Of course he'll fight again. Is he retired? No, he's not retired. And yes, I would expect him to fight within the year. So that's bullshit retirement number two. Which brings us to bullshit retirement number three. Nikki Bella. On the heels of her sister Brie announcing her own retirement on an episode recently of Total Divas or Bellas or Bullshit or whatever the name of the show is, she already announced her retirement a few weeks ago. Nikki followed suit on the season finale of the show. How convenient. The big bombshell that they saved for the season finale. She said she made the decision after the Evolution pay-per-view last year. While she was on a European tour, she realized that she doesn't want to put her body or her surgically repaired neck through the travel and trauma and stress of being a WWE superstar. She feels she's too old for that kind of travel. Why am I doing this? I'm ready to hang up the jersey, she said. And as quickly as that news broke across all of these different wrestling websites, TMZ caught up with her, and already she's saying that she would definitely be open to a return to the ring. provided, of course, that the timing is right. Wrestling retirements are like a streak of good episodes of Raw, right? They don't last very long. Nikki Bella is no different. And maybe it was just these websites getting ahead of themselves. Maybe it was more a case of her saying, I'm retiring from full-time competition. That's also very possible. But I love how the stories were that Nikki Bella retires. Nikki Bella announces her retirement, and now she's on TMZ saying, oh, I'd love to come back and talk about a return to the ring here and there. It's a hell of a retirement. Think of the movie The Princess Bride, where you know he's using that word. He goes, that word. Don't think it means what you think it means. So, Nikki, look, I think that it was a nice little gimmick for the finale of their reality show. Is she retired? Obviously the answer is no. And look, Nikki broke her neck doing something that she was not very good at when she first started. She improved. She got better. I can't say the same for Brie. She tried. I don't doubt that she worked hard, but she wasn't very good. And when the next wave of female talent came up from NXT, the Charlottes and the Sashas and the Askas and the Ember Moons, the Bellas, I think Brie more so than Nikki, look like a relic from an age when the women were marketed mostly just as eye candy. And I know that isn't what they wanted. They say, well, you know, we argued and we fought for longer time in our matches. And, you know, it wasn't their decision to get 30 seconds to go out on Raw, half of which was used for their entrance. So they found success with their reality shows and they just started their own podcast this week. But don't think for a second that Nikki Bella or Brie have wrestled their final match. I fully expect them to be challenging for those women's tag team titles inside of 2 years, if that. Brie wants to have another baby? Okay, fine, have another baby. And after she does, believe me, it won't be long. We're going to be treated to the big Bella comeback. And the eventual Hall of Fame induction, which you know is coming. And you know, for all the people, I have to actually defend Nikki on this. For all the people who crap on Nikki Bella, oh, she's a terrible wrestler and this and that. Before you start throwing the word terrible around, just remember, Rosa Mendez worked for that company for 11 years, the same amount of time that Kofi Kingston has been with WWE. So too was Rosa Mendez. Remember that rumor a while back that Rosa Mendez, because I think she had a kid, she was planning on making a comeback? Well, she gave an interview to the website 411mania.com this week and said that for all of her years in WWE, they would not let her in the ring as much as she wanted to be in the ring. Gee, I wonder why. But they would not let her in the ring as much as she really wanted to be, and she never got a run with the title. And that's why she was planning on making a comeback. She wanted to have one more run for one more year and have a title. And you thought you were angry about Asuka losing her title. Imagine if she had lost it to Rosa Mendez. I mean, dude. Can you imagine? They would do something like that, too. Have Asuka get rolled up on a distraction. Rosa Mendez pins her to win the women's championship. Rosa Mendez makes Nikki Bella look like Lou Thesz. But she was going to come back to have a run with the title. Yeah, if she stole it and strapped it around her waist for her morning jog, she could have a run with it. That's the only run with a title that she's ever going to have. By the way, if things sound a little bit different, it's because I think I had the volume up too high on the microphone now the last several weeks. So I lowered it a little bit. Hopefully it's a little more manageable, but you'll let me know which way you like better. LuchaCentral.com broke the news that the talent being held hostage by Lucha Underground's production company and sued them and the El Rey Network are now free. There had been three different lawsuits filed, two by El Hijo del Fantasma, better known on the show as King Cuerno, and Tejano. They were both seeking financial damages. The third lawsuit was a class action suit on behalf of King Cuerno, Joey Ryan, Ivelisse, and Cobra Moon, who all wanted releases from their Lucha Underground contracts. These were, in most cases, and I can't say that this is the case with everybody who's on Lucha Underground, but these are seven-season deals, seven-year deals, whatever the actual length is, seven seasons these people signed on for. And the show's future is totally up in the air. It sure doesn't look like it's coming back for a fifth season, but they're just kind of stuck in limbo right now. Well, they're stuck no more. Settlement has been reached. The class action suit has been dropped. All four have been released from their contracts. They are now free to pursue work anywhere they want. Cuerno's separate lawsuit has been dropped as well. Cuerno had interest from WWE around the time of the first Cruiserweight Classic, but they would not let him out of his Lucha Underground deal. So he could not be part of it. He's a talented guy. I mean, I think WWE would be smart to snatch him up now that he's free. Joey Ryan, I'm sure WWE, yeah, that's not happening, nor should it. He'll end up working for All Elite Wrestling. He does his thing. He's very successful with it. Good for him. I'm not a fan. But yeah, I'm sure he'll end up working for All Elite. I think he's going to be on the Double or Nothing card. Either that or Brazzers, by the way, you know, his career is going. Ivelisse is the one that I'm most excited about out of these four. She came off as just a total badass on that show. I think she would be a great addition to any women's division, the division in NXT, Raw, SmackDown. Now, I know she didn't leave WWE on the best of terms the first time. I know she has said that she believes she was... Her being one of the first people to kind of sound the alarm bells about Bill DeMott when he used to be running things down in developmental, she's convinced that that had something to do with her release, and maybe it did. I remember there being stories about her having attitude problems. That could have been leaked by the WWE side to make her look bad. Or maybe she really did have attitude problems. It's hard to, you know, sometimes they say you have one side of the story, then you have the other side of the story, and then you have the truth, which is somewhere in the middle, and that may be the case here. So she didn't leave on the best of terms, but that was 7 years ago. You know, her and hopefully, I mean, I would hope by now that's water under the bridge. Her and Cuerno both, I think, would be great additions, ideally on NXT, because they would just end up putting a fucking piñata in Cuerno's hand and sending him out there with the Lucha House Party. I have zero faith in what they would do with him on that show. But as far as NXT roster additions, especially when there's rumors of Velveteen Dream maybe being called up. We know Aleister Black and Ricochet probably are going to be full-time now on the main roster. Who else? Who else is going to be called up? There's going to be others. They're having a big draft in April. You don't think they could use somebody like a Cuerno or like an Ivelisse on the NXT roster? Of course they could. So you guys know, there is a sale. I forgot to mention this earlier. Starting Wednesday, this Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern through next Monday, it's the annual Pro Wrestling Tees Mania Weekend Sale. You can get 20% off all shirts in our Sound Off store and free shipping on any order over $150 if you order a whole bunch of shirts and go crazy. Just use the promo code MANIA at checkout starting Wednesday. I love seeing Sound Off shirts at all the shows I go to. So now would be a great time to pick one up. They won't come in time for Mania, unfortunately, but if you want to pick up one shirt, pick up a whole bunch of them, now's a great time. Starting Wednesday, 20% off, prowrestlingtees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Raw last Monday was live from Boston, Massachusetts. We had over 3,000 votes in our Twitter poll, at Solomonster. That's where you can find me and vote in the polls every week. 21% thumbs up, 79% thumbs down. We are on the road to WrestleMania, people. 21 up, 79 down. This was the very definition of a filler episode, especially the beat the clock stuff with the women. I'm still wondering what the point of that even was. I lost track of how many times Renee Young shouted, "Oh my God!" on this show.
Oh my God!
If I made a drinking game out of it, I would be dead right now. Some WrestleMania updates. It's looking like a high around 57 degrees, low of 42 degrees or so. That's Fahrenheit, by the way. I have to remind myself we have a lot of international listeners. That doesn't mean it's going to be 107 degrees outside. I'd be sitting in the air-conditioned club lounge if that were the case. I might be sitting in there anyway. The good news right now is no rain in the forecast for Sunday. Of course, we're a week away. That could change. We could get the mother of all blizzards next Sunday. But there is no rain in the forecast. There is rain in the forecast, unfortunately, for Friday and Saturday, but not Sunday. So just monitor it throughout the week, I guess, if you're coming in, and come to the stadium prepared, because if it is going to rain, remember, this is a long show. Even a little bit of drizzle, I don't know if you want to just be sitting out there like that for 8 straight hours. It's probably no bueno. The Hart Foundation is now official for the Hall of Fame induction ceremony next Saturday. No Jimmy Hart. Remember, the first rumor, the first report that came out about the Hall of Fame was from PW Insider. They broke the story weeks ago that the Hart Foundation tag team with Jimmy Hart, who would then become, like Brett, a 2-time Hall of Fame inductee, that the three of them would be going in. And then we heard nothing about it. And DX was announced, and Honky Tonk Man, and Tori Wilson, and all of these other people, and we're starting to wonder, maybe they nixed the Hart Foundation. Maybe they got axed after they decided they were going to put DX in. And we finally got the announcement this week, but it's just for Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, not Jimmy Hart, which is fine. I mean, look, Jimmy's already in the Hall of Fame. And so it's just, and plus, you know, Jimmy was not with them for the entire length of their run. So I don't have an issue with them cutting him out of the picture. I think it's very cool that the Hart Foundation will get the Hall of Fame treatment. I think that as a tag team, if you're putting in famous tag teams, the Hart Foundation belongs in there. The Bulldogs belong in there. Demolition belongs in there. Hopefully in due time, they'll all get the Hall of Fame treatment. Brutus the Barber Beefcake is likely to be the final inductee announced this week, probably to be inducted by Hulk Hogan, which is why both of them are going to be in town this weekend for WrestleMania. I expect the announcement to probably come as early as Raw tomorrow night that Beefcake's going in. Bam Bam Bigelow, though, shunned in New Jersey. That's too bad, because the rumor last year was he was going in, and then at the last minute he didn't. And the idea was that they're going to wait a year and induct him when WrestleMania comes to his home state of New Jersey. Well, here we are now in his home state of New Jersey, and we only have 1 week left, and it doesn't look like Bam Bam's going into the Hall of Fame. I mean, here's a guy who even named his finish after a city in New Jersey, right? Greetings from Asbury Park. I mean, who's more Jersey than Bam? Well, I guess DDP maybe, but he's already in the Hall of Fame. So that's too bad. WWE made it official this week that for the first time in history, the women will headline WrestleMania and will close out the show.
Oh my God!
It's the right call to make. The decision apparently came down. I find this intriguing. The decision apparently came down to the wire, not with the Daniel Bryan Kofi Kingston match, but with the Seth Rollins Brock Lesnar match for the Universal Championship. The fact that we even came that close to that match going on last is pretty scary. Because I don't know about you, and I know Brock is sort of the big champion in the company and all that. I get that. And he headlined last year against Roman Reigns, and we all know how that went. I don't expect this match to go nearly as badly as that one did. But it just feels like there's no real excitement around that match. Am I wrong? Is there this great palpable excitement for Seth Rollins against Brock Lesnar that I'm missing? Because it doesn't feel like it. The decision should not have come down to the wire at all. This decision should have been made at least a month ago. Despite all the topsy-turvy bullshit that they've done with the women's storyline, this was really the only way to go. And if you made an argument for any other match going on last, I believe that argument would not be for Seth Rollins and Brock Lesnar. It would be for Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan if Kofi is going to win the championship. That should have been the only decision. So that's kind of scary that it came down that close. As Paul O'Brien pointed out, Becky Lynch becomes the first non-North American star to ever compete in a WrestleMania main event, closing out the show. She is only second, to Andre the Giant. Of course, Andre headlined WrestleMania 3 against Hogan. Andre comes from France. And no, Yokozuna does not count. He was born in San Francisco, so I don't want to hear about Yokozuna. Becky Lynch is riding high right now. Pro Wrestling Sheet says she was offered a brand new contract earlier this month with a raise, and it hasn't apparently been signed yet, but she's expected to sign it any day now. If she hasn't, maybe in the past week or so, she should get a raise. Absolutely. Especially if she's their top merchandise seller, which apparently she is. I saw Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful.com. He said that she's been the top merch seller for a while now. This is not a new thing. You know, and when you think about Becky Lynch, her story is really something else. And I don't think they've done a very good job, frankly, of telling this story. I know they have their TV story. So their TV story is that Charlotte is handed everything and Becky has to scratch and claw and fight. And Becky, you know, the fans, just this groundswell of support for her. And she won the Royal Rumble. And now all the bullshit she's had to go through in the last 2 months, right? Since the Royal Rumble. That's the story. Why not go back farther than that? Here's a woman who suffered a serious head injury in the ring in 2006 that was thought to be possibly the end of her career. She wrestled, you know how many matches she wrestled in the next 6 years after that head injury? In 6 years. You know how many matches? 3. She wrestled 3 matches in the next 6 years before she finally signed a developmental deal with WWE. Then she debuted, you remember that, dancing an Irish jig on the way to the ring. You had Dusty Rhodes. The last tweet that Dusty Rhodes ever posted before he died said, Becky Lynch, top 5 star of the last 5 years, max number 1. That was over 3 years before she attacked Charlotte after their match at SummerSlam and her big push really took off. Dusty was a prophet. Now that SummerSlam thing was meant to be a heel turn, but that's not how the fans took it. Then came the punch from Nia Jax, and that really just sealed the deal and put her over the top. That Rousey match, in hindsight, being canceled for Survivor Series, was the best thing that could have ever happened to her. I fully believe that this WrestleMania main event is Ronda Rousey one-on-one against Charlotte Flair. That's the match, if the Survivor Series match with Ronda and Becky goes off as planned. I don't believe we're sitting here talking about a three-way for the Women's Championship. And here she is now, the first woman to headline WrestleMania, and probably winning. She should win. I don't think there could be any other outcome here but Becky Lynch winning. So she's got a brand new contract, big pay raise, top merch seller. It's a great story. Only problem is, of course, there's nowhere for her to go but down, right? This is what always happens when you have somebody in her position. Unless you're a Stone Cold and, you know, you can just maintain popularity for the rest of your life. Problem is, there's nowhere for her to go but down. I'm waiting for all of these fickle fans to turn on her like they do everybody else until the next woman comes along and they get behind her and they start booing Becky. Joan Jett is going to perform Bad Reputation live and sing Ronda Rousey to the ring at WrestleMania.
Oh my God!
One of the things that depressed me this week was the number of people I saw online making comments like, who's Joan Jett? Joan Jett, for the uninformed, is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And if you've ever heard the song I Love Rock and Roll, you've likely heard the version that she and the Blackhearts recorded back in the 80s. They didn't write the song, but they sang the most popular version of it. Now I'm going to get emails from people telling me, no, Solomonster, that's a Britney Spears song. That'd be like somebody telling me Stone Cold didn't popularize the Stunner. That's a Kevin Owens move. Fuck off. The Beat the Clock gimmick. I hate the Beat the Clock gimmick. I think I've made this clear on this show over the years. I like it as much as I like that old scramble match that they used to do. You know what? There's a reason they don't do it anymore, because it was stupid. I don't like it. It's nothing more than time filler, this beat the clock stuff. But at least in the past when we've seen it, there are instances where it kind of makes sense to use it. It could be used to determine a number one contender or some such thing. Here, it was for the all-important momentum going into WrestleMania. Not only was this a pointless waste of time, it made the Riot Squad look like a bunch of pushovers, which is great when you announce a match for next week with Ronda, Becky, and Charlotte teaming up against the Riot Squad. As though we're suddenly supposed to be interested in seeing such a match. I'd rather see them play fucking musical chairs. Musical chairs, by the way, is still one of the most entertaining segments in the history of Monday Night Raw. Almost entirely due to the Nature Boy Ric Flair. Would you rather see the three of them play musical chairs or wrestle the Riot Squad? I know what I would choose, and I'm not even trying to knock the Riot Squad. I'm just saying, I watch what they did here, and then they announced this match for next week, and I said, why in God's name would I give a shit after what you did here to even see that match? I have no interest. Play musical chairs. Ronda set the pace. She beat Sarah Logan in a minute 25. Charlotte then failed to beat Ruby Riott in that same amount of time. She was out. And then Becky Lynch. I'm going to get it right one of these days. Becky Lynch beat Liv Morgan. There we go. There, I just slapped myself. Becky Lynch beat Liv Morgan in a minute 19 to win the beat the clock, whatever the fuck, gauntlet, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what this was. This was dumb. This was pointless. This was dumb. This was just a way to get them on the show. They couldn't think of something else. This was the best they could come up with. Finn Balor, he's going to get his rematch for the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania after beating Bobby Lashley and Jinder Mahal in a handicap match. Again, no mention of the Demon. I don't think they need it, but they've got one more week to announce it. Aleister Black and Ricochet beat the Raw Tag Team Champions in a non-title match. Second time now that they've done that. Sounds more impressive than it really is, considering it's the Revival. I'm pretty sure the British Bulldogs beat them last week, and they're both dead.
Oh my God!
Black and Ricochet get a tag team title match against them tomorrow night. According to Post Wrestling, which is over where John Pollock is these days, there will be tag team title matches. Plural. Matches. Added to the WrestleMania card. The SmackDown match is expected to be the Usos defending against multiple teams to get everybody on the card. The Raw match, my guess, is going to be the Revival defending against Black and Ricochet after some kind of a DQ finish in their title match on Raw tomorrow night. I would assume they come back, do it again at WrestleMania, and we may well see them win those tag team titles at WrestleMania, because I don't think Black and Ricochet are winning the NXT tag team titles on Friday night. I could see them losing there, but then winning at WrestleMania. I mean, they're unbeaten. I believe they're unbeaten one-on-one as a tag team since coming up to the main roster. They're certainly doing a better job of protecting Black and Ricochet than they are their Raw Tag Team Champions. But apparently they felt like with Asuka no longer having the SmackDown Women's title and having to defend it, that they could add another match or two to the card, and that's the current plan. We had a segment with Drew McIntyre coming out and talking more about Roman Reigns, and Roman finally comes out and says he accepts Drew's challenge for WrestleMania, but that's as Roman Reigns. As Joe, you better not talk about my wife and kids again. Then they get into a pull-apart brawl, and Roman, I think, got laid out, if I remember, by a Claymore kick. All this stuff kind of runs together. So that sets up their match at WrestleMania, which just feels like, you know, just like mid-card kind of stuff. I mean, there really is... They've done a very good job of building up Drew as this killer. And if Roman is back and healthy, it's crazy, I guess, not to include him on the WrestleMania card. So, hey, why not put the two of them together? But I don't know. I just feel like there's so many matches already on this show. It's just hard for me to get excited about it. But it's a great spot for Drew to be in. Have a singles match at WrestleMania against Roman Reigns, the guy who just headlined countless WrestleMania shows. He's come a long way from, you know, three-man band and all the garbage they had him doing just a few years ago. We had a moment of bliss with Braun Strowman. That makes it sound like he hosted the segment. That's what they'll have him doing next, hosting his own talk show. Alexa was trying to mediate things with Braun and the SNL goofs, Michael Che and Colin Jost, who appeared via satellite. Jost acknowledged the mistake he made wearing a New York Mets hat in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, and he promised he's not going to do that again, and then he put a Yankee hat on. And the Boston crowd did not find this amusing. Braun suggested that Jost enter the Andre Battle Royal at WrestleMania, or else the both of them are going to get their asses kicked, and then Michael Che, scared by that, accepted on Jost's behalf. So Colin Jost is now in the Andre Battle Royal at WrestleMania. Then Michael Che got added to the match. And so now both of them are in the Battle Royal at WrestleMania, as I pretty much called it last week. I mean, they're both in the Battle Royal. That seemed the obvious way they were going with this. The only question is, who do they eliminate? Because you know they're going to be eliminating somebody. I could see a situation here where Jost eliminates Che, and then while he's pointing and laughing and getting all cocky, that's when Braun dumps him out of the ring. All we need is one big gust of wind to come sweeping through MetLife Stadium for this match and blow Colin Jost right off into the Jersey fucking Sound out there. Now that would be a WrestleMania moment. Jersey Sound, that's a band. I don't know where I got that from. Whatever body of water is closest to the stadium, just blow them into it. I enjoyed watching Impact this week. First Samoa Joe against Kurt Angle on Monday, and then Kurt Angle against AJ Styles on Tuesday. Now all we need is Sting to be his opponent tomorrow night, and then replace Baron Corbin at WrestleMania with Jeff Jarrett. All of Angle's opponents on his farewell tour have been chosen by Angle himself. So Apollo Crews, Chad Gable, Samoa Joe, AJ Styles, and tomorrow night, Rey Mysterio. All handpicked by Kurt. Not bad choices at all. The one man who was not handpicked by Kurt Angle, despite what they'll tell you on TV, is Baron Corbin. All of these great opponents, just to build to Baron Corbin at WrestleMania. It's like hitting home runs during the regular season and then going 0 for 5 with a walk during the World Series. Or as I call it, the Alex Rodriguez. Although he did have that one postseason in 2009, I guess, where he kind of redeemed himself. John Cena has no announced match for WrestleMania. No role for WrestleMania. If anything, it'll be a surprise, whatever they have him doing. I don't think he's scheduled to be at TV this week. But we'll see, right? Stranger things have happened. Maybe he'll pop up as a surprise this week and we'll get a better sense. But, you know, him, I'm seeing these rumors of him maybe doing something with Elias. And it's like, you know, him interrupting an Elias concert would be a waste. Since they already had an interaction at WrestleMania last year. Better to do something with him and Kurt. Even if it's just to come out after Kurt's match is over. For some kind of a speech in the ring or a little send-off or something. Some kind of interaction between the two of them, I think, is warranted. I mean, look, I really wish they would have come to their senses and just changed the match. There's a reason that John Cena was chosen to be the person to induct Kurt Angle into the Hall of Fame. This should have been an easy slam dunk call. Now, even if Cena does come out after for another match, you look at this year's WrestleMania card and you think to yourself, you know what's missing? You know what's really missing? This WrestleMania card this year could really use, I know, another match. Because we don't have enough of those. So it's almost like at this point, do we even want Kurt Angle to challenge John Cena or John Cena to come out and have another match if the Corbin match is happening no matter what? Do we really need a second match? That would make what, 17? 18 if they add those two tag team title matches? I mean, come on. But, you know, you watch Kurt Angle in the ring on this farewell tour, especially in there with Joe on Monday. And look, it was cool to see the two of them in the ring one last time together like that, but yeah, they even had a callback at the beginning of the match to their very first face-to-face in TNA when Kurt gave him that headbutt that busted him open. Here, Joe gave Kurt a headbutt, kind of in the shoulder, but still, he gave him a headbutt to start the match. Later on, he had Kurt in the Coquina Clutch. Kurt cradled him for the win. So Kurt Angle pins the United States champion here, Samoa Joe. But you watch this and the other matches as well, and it is painfully obvious this retirement is a good 2 years too late. Probably more than that. Kurt posted this on his Facebook page. WrestleMania is around the corner. My very last match, I know it's not the old Kurt Angle that everybody has wanted, but I'm proud knowing it's the new Kurt Angle that has been clean for almost 6 years. Thank you to all of you who have been supporting me through the good and the bad. I love you all. And that really is the most important thing to remember in all of this. This is a man who 13 years ago, when he left WWE, Vince McMahon let him out of his contract. Think of how fucked up Angle had to have been at that time that Vince McMahon would just let one of his top stars, an Olympic gold medalist, out of his contract, no strings attached. I don't think there was a non-compete for like 90 days or anything like that. Just a full release from an existing live, active contract. Free to sign with any company he wanted to, which is exactly what he did. He went right to TNA within a month. He signed with TNA. And what does that say about TNA? That they were so quick to sign him, they had to have known he was going through some pretty serious issues. But, look, you know, Kurt Angle becomes free. I guess it's hard to turn that down. So he found a home in TNA. I remember Vince McMahon at the time when he let him go, saying he did a whole interview with WWE.com, and he said that Kurt needed time away from the ring to take care of his demons. He knew how close to death Kurt Angle was. Then a few weeks later, he signs with TNA. And Kurt starts talking about how, oh, that WWE schedule, that almost killed me. It wasn't all the stuff he was doing that almost killed him. It was the schedule. We'll just blame it all on the schedule. But then there were the years of DUI arrests. Vince wouldn't even entertain the idea of bringing Kurt back. You know, when Kurt would make overtures about coming back, or people internally would float the idea about Kurt Angle coming in, it's like Macho Man. You know, the story about how over the years, whenever somebody, Michael Hayes might have done this once in a meeting where they floated the idea of doing something with Randy Savage, or bringing back the Macho Man, or bringing him in for the Hall of Fame. And the famous story about Vince McMahon looking off into the distance or looking off out the window and just saying something to the effect of, don't ever mention that name ever again in front of me. It's like, holy shit. But Kurt was basically persona non grata for so long in that company. Why do you think that is? He wouldn't even entertain the idea for years of bringing this guy back. Kurt Angle. He didn't want Kurt Angle back, because he didn't want an Olympic gold medalist to die while he was working for his company. Now, Kurt got his life cleaned up. Ever since he's come back, he's been a model citizen. But clean and sober for 6 years is a much bigger deal than any wrestling match this guy could have. Because there were a lot of people, I would argue, that had this guy in their death pool many years ago, the way things were going for him. Probably the same thing for Matt Hardy, when Matt was getting all those DUI arrests and going through all the stuff that he was going through. It wasn't looking good. And actually, now both of them are doing great. Matt's got, you know, his kids and his wife, and he just lost, I think, 15 or 20 pounds. Physically, he's looking in great shape. Kurt, not so much. I mean, look, for a guy his age, he's still in good shape, but, you know, it's painful to watch Kurt move around. He moves around so stiff. He looks stiff as a board. But if that's the product of not being hooked up on pain pills, you know what? So be it. So be it. The guy has a wife. He's got 5 kids or maybe more than that. I don't know. But, you know, I'd like to see Kurt Angle be one of these guys who defies the odds of what people thought was going to happen 10 years ago and still be around when he's 60 and 70 years old. He may be completely crippled up by then. I don't know. But that really, to me, in reading that blog post on his Facebook page, that really drove it home that that's the real story here. That Kurt was even able to make a comeback, that he's even able to step in the ring and do what he's doing. And now, I don't know how the match is going to be. It's not the ideal opponent, but he's going to get a big send-off at WrestleMania in front of 80,000 people. I don't know if he'll get pyro and all that, but this is the way that Kurt Angle should be able to go out. I only wish the circumstances and the opponent were better, but I guess you can't always get what you want. So that is the real story here, I think. And look, you look at what Kurt's done since he's come back. They welcomed him back into the company. He got that Hall of Fame induction. He got to work with Ronda Rousey in what was the best match on the WrestleMania card last year. He was the Raw general manager for about a year and a half. But he got that Hall of Fame induction, and a lot of inductees, they don't live long enough to enjoy their Hall of Fame induction. So he's got one more match before WrestleMania. They said his match with AJ on Tuesday was the final SmackDown match of his career. So that leaves the match with Rey Mysterio tomorrow night. Another SmackDown star being loaned over to Raw. It's a risk, I think, when you put him in there for as many matches as they've been. I mean, the match with AJ on Tuesday was like 90 seconds, but it's a risk. Putting Kurt Angle at this stage in the ring with his past injury issues, I think Rey Mysterio is about as safe an opponent as you could think of, but that doesn't mean one wrong step and, you know, the guy could get hurt. It's like he's made of glass. So I think it is a risk. He and Ray had a fun little feud in 2002. The little boys promo on SmackDown was hilarious. You're telling Rey Mysterio, remember one thing, Ray, you're a boy in a man's world, and I'm a man that loves to play with boys. Comedy Kurt is still my favorite version of Kurt Angle. Their match at SummerSlam that year was a lot of fun, and so I think Ray is a fitting choice as one of his last opponents. Triple H came out to the ring to show the world a letter that he received from Batista's lawyer. Nothing more exciting than a lawyer's letter. Of course, he did this not before struggling to pull the envelope out of his jacket pocket. He wouldn't job to Booker T, but he'll job to a fucking envelope. It says, Batista will not compete at WrestleMania unless Triple H agrees to another stipulation. And here I thought Batista got what he wants. Apparently not. This man doesn't know what he wants. He wanted Triple H to admit that the only reason he started Evolution was to help him keep the World Heavyweight title. And Triple H congratulated him on realizing that after all these years, realizing what everybody else already knew. Triple H said that Batista was actually better off for having been a part of Evolution. He should be grateful, which is undoubtedly true. And that he only quit the first time because he knew he couldn't beat John Cena. And the stipulation that Batista wants is that if he wins, Triple H, as Batista has basically gone on record as saying this is going to be his last match no matter what, he wants the stipulation that when Triple H loses, he has to retire. Triple H said, if I can't beat a douchebag like Batista, I don't belong in the ring anyway. And he agreed to it. Maybe they can pin each other and both retire. A double retirement. The show closed with a last man standing match between Drew McIntyre and Dean Ambrose. It was good for what it was. It was short. It was about a 10-minute last man standing match. They had 10 minutes to get their shit in before they have, they have that hard stop now at 11 p.m. Ambrose hit dirty deeds, but Drew made it back up to his feet at the count of 7. Ambrose set the table up in the corner, which backfired on him when Drew picked him up and put him through it.
Oh my God!
Ambrose made it back to his feet, but ate a Claymore kick, and there was no getting up from that. McIntyre wins. No appearance here by Roman Reigns, despite what happened earlier in the show. Not the first time in the last few weeks that Ambrose has been left laying, and there's no Roman Reigns coming out to make the save for his brother-in-arms. Makes me wonder if there still might be a turn coming for Ambrose to cost Roman the match at WrestleMania. You know, but if his contract is up at the end of April, if they did some kind of turn like that, or they were going to have a brief feud with Roman and Dean, they'd have to blow it off on TV since the next pay-per-view isn't until the Saudi Arabia show on May 3rd. You know, between all the jobs that he's been doing week after week, the fact that he doesn't even have a match right now on the WrestleMania card, where are all these people, all these other shows that said, oh, it's just a work, you're being worked, he ain't leaving, you're all being worked. Where are all those people now? Notice how silent they've all gotten. He's doing the honors on the way out. That's what's going on here. SmackDown Live from the Mohegan Sun Arena in Connecticut. Over 3,100 votes. One of these rare weeks we had more votes in the SmackDown poll than we did the Raw poll. And it was almost the reverse outcome. 69% thumbs up, 31% thumbs down. So much for trading pancakes for pipes. New Day opened the show by basically skipping to the ring and tossing pancakes out to the crowd. Oh well. Vince McMahon came out, followed by Daniel Bryan and Rowan, and Daniel Bryan told Vince, look, if they want to quit, let them quit. They're a nostalgia act. You can just call up 3 stars from NXT, call them Fresh Afternoon, and have them throw waffles into the crowd. Would that be like a bizarro version of New Day? I think it would be. That sounds like the perfect idea, by the way, for the Forgotten Sons. It'd be more interesting than just being the Forgotten Sons. Have them come to the ring, call them Fresh Afternoon, throw waffles out to the people. Jackson Ryker could have that same scowl on his face the entire time, like, what the fuck am I doing here? That would be more entertaining than what they're doing now. Vince ended up making yet another gauntlet match. He has a fetish now for gauntlet matches. This time with Big E and Xavier, having to run the gauntlet, and if they could successfully run the gauntlet, Kofi Kingston would get his championship match at WrestleMania. I didn't like the way they set this up at all. Why would New Day even agree to another gauntlet after Vince already fucked them out of the last one? Like, I'm watching their reaction here, and I'm like, Big E's like bobbing his head up and down. Okay, we got this, we got this. I'm like, you got what? You've got shit. Why would you take this man at his word? He has fucked you at every opportunity. You're going to run another hour-long gauntlet only for him to do the same thing at the end? It's like they didn't seem bothered by this at all. So I didn't like that. We've got Charlotte and Asuka. This was an impromptu match for the SmackDown Women's Championship. This match should have taken place at WrestleMania. According to The Observer, the decision to do the title change was made earlier that same day. The original plan was for Mandy Rose to win the Fatal 4-Way that they had announced. It was going to be Mandy, Sonya, Carmella, and Naomi, who's been very vocal on Twitter of late, probably much to her detriment. And Mandy was going to win that match and wrestle Asuka again at WrestleMania. They had already wrestled at Fastlane. Asuka won that match, and Asuka likely would have beaten her again at WrestleMania to retain the championship. That would have been very weird because, again, they just did that match. So unless they were going to do a title change and put the belt on Mandy, I don't see the purpose in doing that. Yeah, but they have already a lot of matches planned. Maybe that went into it. They want to try to consolidate things. And so the decision was made to take the title off of Asuka. Now, before I talk about the title change and all that, kind of lost in all that noise is the fact that these two went out and had a very good match, much like the match they had last year at WrestleMania. Charlotte hit a Spanish fly off the top rope for a near fall. Asuka put her in a triangle. Charlotte muscled her up into a powerbomb for another near fall. Asuka lock attempt countered into the figure eight for the tap out. It's WrestleMania 34 all over again. Charlotte wins her eighth championship. This was a very good match. Much as I despise what they have done with Asuka, it truly is vile and disgusting what they have done with Asuka. Just since winning the championship, let alone since the Royal Rumble, she beat Becky Lynch. Becky Lynch is headlining at WrestleMania. What's Asuka doing? Toiling in the Battle Royal. Probably not even winning it. I think it's disgusting what they have done. Despite that, despite my feelings on that, Charlotte getting a random title match fits the narrative of her being handed everything, right? She was gifted a spot in the main event of WrestleMania. She was gifted a title match here on this show. Meanwhile, Becky has to scratch and claw and fight for everything. That's the story. That's the story that they're telling. And Charlotte is now the first to ever be an 8-time women's champion in WWE. She's halfway to her father's record. Think about that. She's already halfway home. She's only the second woman, though, to be an overall 8-time champion in WWE. Trish Stratus was the first. Let's not forget, you know, besides being a 7-time women's champion and being able to retire as the women's champion, Trish is also a former hardcore champion. So that makes 8 total for her. So Charlotte still has some work to do on that. Could they insert Asuka into the main event of WrestleMania and make it a fatal 4-way? Yes. Will they? No. Now, she does have a submission win. I would hope they don't forget this. She has a, not just a win, a submission win. Becky didn't pass out. She tapped out at the Royal Rumble to Asuka. That could be an angle to pursue if they wanted to get her into the match at WrestleMania. But, you know, see, I didn't even want this to be a triple threat match. I wanted this to be one-on-one. You think I want a fatal four-way? This has turned into such a mess. And, you know, Asuka is officially relegated to the Battle Royal. She is on Battle Royal duty at WrestleMania, probably being eliminated, if we're being honest, at the very end by Lacey fucking Evans. So now all the attention shifts over to the main event of WrestleMania. Raw Women's Championship is on the line. Ronda Rousey defends against Charlotte. She defends against Becky Lynch. There's a lot of rumors now that this is going to turn into a winner-take-all scenario or some kind of a title unification at WrestleMania. The only thing we know is that nobody knows. So whatever you've read, whatever you've heard, whatever I talk about here, this is all rumor and speculation. Nobody will know until they go on the air tomorrow night on Raw what they are going to do with the title. So let me just say that first and foremost. This is all speculation. We don't even know yet if the SmackDown Women's Championship is going to be on the line. But if this rumor is true, it will be. If they want the Four Horsewomen celebration, with all the women holding up titles to end the show, I can see it being a case where if Becky pins Ronda, for example, or makes her tap, she wins the Raw Women's title, but Charlotte gets to keep the SmackDown Women's title because she wasn't beaten directly for it. That way, Charlotte maybe, you know, grudgingly when the match is over, out of respect, stays in the ring and holds up her title. Becky holds up her title. Sasha and Bayley, after retaining, come down and hold up their tag team titles. And you get the big photo op. Yes, I can see that happening. I think that that might even be likely. I think that would take some of the shine off of Becky. She should have the celebration for herself. It's been her story. There's been no involvement with any of the other horsewomen. This is not a horsewomen story. It's a Becky Lynch story. It should be Becky Lynch, if she wins, in the ring celebrating with the big pyro celebration. Not with Charlotte, not with Bayley, not with Sasha. But I could see them wanting to do that. But here's the thing. Everyone's throwing around this winner-take-all terminology here, right? That's not winner-take-all. I don't know why people are calling that winner-take-all. Winner-take-all means exactly what it says. Whoever wins the match, regardless of who gets pinned or who submits, that person wins all the gold. That would be winner-take-all. Which means no horsewomen photo op there at the end with everybody holding up belts. You can still do a photo op, but only one person would have both the Raw and the SmackDown women's belt. Charlotte would be empty-handed if it were true winner-take-all rules. But I really don't think they need to be unifying anything if they're probably just going to split it again before SmackDown moves to Fox, because you know damn well they're not sending SmackDown to Fox without having its own champion. I would just have Becky win the Raw title and keep her and Charlotte apart on separate brands with their own belts. Let Charlotte defend on SmackDown, let Becky defend on Raw. I don't see the need for there to be a unification. We had Kurt Angle against AJ Styles. They shook hands, adhering to the code of honor here before this match. Kurt immediately hit a German suplex. I will say this, in the 75 seconds or 90 seconds this went, Kurt looked good. I think if you keep Kurt to 90 seconds, he'll look just fine. It didn't take very long for Randy Orton to come in. He hit AJ with an RKO for the DQ. Didn't touch Kurt. So this was a waste. If you were expecting some kind of real match between Kurt Angle and AJ Styles, you were left disappointed. But you got to understand something here. This is not, as Kurt said on his own Facebook page, he is not the Kurt Angle of old. Kurt is not going to go out there and have the kind of match with AJ Styles that he had with him in TNA. It's just not possible. And I think it's a risk to put him out there at all for any matches before WrestleMania because he can get hurt. You know, you're building his retirement match as one of the big attractions at WrestleMania this year. You know, what if he goes in there and he rolls his ankle, hurts his knee? You know, Kurt Angle is physically not, I don't think, in a position where he should be out there wrestling every single week on every single show. So it probably was for the best they kept this very limited. I suspect it'll be very similar to what they do with him and Ray on Monday night. We had The Miz and Shane McMahon advancing their feud. Miz was in the ring. Shane came out. He was flanked by security and Sanity. I guess Sanity now doubles as security at these shows. They're certainly not wrestling. And Miz was cutting this, you know, promo, and Shane went off on him and got very personal with some of the insults and talked about what a Miz stake it was for his parents to get together and have him. And that set off Miz, and he charged and tried to get to Shane, but he couldn't break through the barrier of security and Sanity, and Shane got away. So he beat up Sanity. It spilled into the crowd. Shane got away. Again, not one of the higher matches on the card at WrestleMania, but it's been a very well-constructed, well-built feud now going back a number of months. And that's really the kind of match that you should be building towards WrestleMania. I wish they would have had enough foresight in some of these other feuds. Not just the son of the boss. Of course, Shane they were going to take care of. They've carefully crafted this story now, going back to the last Saudi show. If only they had taken that same care with some of the other matches. Big E and Xavier had to run the gauntlet. Kofi Kingston was banned. He was banished to the back. New Day beat the Good Brothers in less than a minute. Blink and you missed it. The Good Brothers, by the way, Anderson and Gallows, have also been taken off the road for all the house shows, which means they don't make the live event pay. contract negotiations here don't seem to be going well between the two sides. New Day then beat Shinsuke Nakamura and Rusev. Xavier pinned Nakamura after New Day hit the midnight hour. New Day beat Sheamus and Cesaro. That was their toughest challenge up to this point. The bar set up for white noise. Big E pulled Cesaro out of the ring. Woods rolled up Sheamus for the win. After the match, the bar attacked both of them, sour sports that they are, and put Big E through a table in the ring, left him laying. Out next were the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, the Usos. They were licking their chops. Then they had second thoughts. They grabbed the microphone and they, you know, talked about how they and New Day have a long history that goes back. They've had many matches. They've had many wars together. And they respect them and basically wished them good luck. They said, "We forfeit." And the place cheered, and I thought that was the best part of this whole thing. Aside from the finish, which was they had a hot finish of the match, but I love that. I love that the New Day came, or Usos rather, came out. They showed respect. They've had their issues. They've had their wars together. We saw them during the last gauntlet. They were in the back with Big E and Xavier watching on the monitor and rooting on Kofi. So I like that dynamic. I actually really like that they came out and they forfeited the match and they walked to the back and everybody cheered. And out next, and by the way, the Usos are probably going to get on the WrestleMania card. It's not official yet. They're going to probably shoehorn a multi-team match in there for WrestleMania. They're another one, like the Good Brothers. We've heard about their contracts being up soon. I've heard nothing about them re-signing, and supposedly their deals were up in April. If you're the Usos, you've done all that there is to do in WWE, and yeah, you're probably making good money in WWE as well. You've got great visibility, and your wife, in the case of Jimmy, she works for the company as well, although clearly she is still very upset about not being featured more prominently. She's made that very clear on Twitter. But if you're the Usos, you've done all you can do. You're like 5 or 6-time tag team champions now. In all the years that you've been in the company, the very first time you ever got on the card together for an actual WrestleMania match on the main card was last year. And now here you are this year, you may not even get on the card again. And if you do, they're just going to shoehorn you in there just so they can say they fit you on the card. You know, when you're thinking about whether or not to re-sign, that's got to go into your thinking. This is how they think of us. They prioritize us so much. We're almost an afterthought, if we even are lucky enough to make it onto the WrestleMania card. I don't know why they would stick around. So their future is also going to be very interesting to follow. And if they drop those tag team titles at WrestleMania, I suspect that's because they haven't signed yet. And it's possible that they decide to leave. Otherwise, I would expect them to retain. I mean, who else are they going to put the belts on? The Hardys? Give them a nostalgia run? Maybe. New Day? New Day doesn't need those belts. Who else is there? So we had New Day, though, in their final fall here against Daniel Bryan and Rowan. This was the last challenge thrown at them by Vince McMahon. Rowan tried to give Woods the Iron Claw, where he grabs you by the head, basically, and lifts you up and slams you. He was going to put him to the announce table, but he slipped out, and Woods sent Rowan into the ring post head first. Big E sent Rowan hurling over the announce table, and then Big E turned the announce table over on top of Rowan. Rowan was unable to answer the 10 count. The fans were counting along. They weren't being dicks where they just count 10. Remember, they were doing that for a while because of Ty Dillinger. They would just chant 10 whenever somebody was outside the ring being counted out. They chanted along 1, 2, 3 until they finally hit 10, and the place went nuts on a count-out win. They lost their minds, and the New Day won the gauntlet. Kofi Kingston is coming to WrestleMania. He came out to celebrate with his boys. Everybody was cheering and laughing and smiling and happy. One person who is not happy that Kofi Kingston is going to WrestleMania is superstar Billy Graham. As soon as I saw the headline about an angry Hall of Famer sounding off about Kofi Kingston getting a title match at WrestleMania, I knew exactly who it was referring to. Like I know the back of my own hand. Before I even clicked on the story, I knew who it was going to be about, and I wasn't disappointed. Superstar is appalled that, in his words, A 145-pound man is going to challenge for the WWE title. Two lightweights, in fact. He shit on Daniel Bryan, too. All the steroids apparently didn't just rot out the guy's hips. They rotted out his brain, too. From what orifice did he pull this 145-pound number? They list Kofi at 212, okay? Even if you account for that being an inflated number, because they do that with everybody, the height, the weight, they're not always accurate. Even if 212 is an exaggerated number, if you believe that that is not the actual weight of Kofi Kingston is not 145 pounds. Billy Graham just added 60 pounds to Kofi Kingston. He's the worst diet in the world. Now, you're certainly entitled to not be a fan of the smaller wrestlers, but there is something awfully rich about that critique coming from a man who destroyed every organ in his body from abusing steroids to maintain the physique that won him that very same championship all those years ago. If Billy Graham, I mean, look, he had the gift of gab, so he had charisma, he could talk, but if you think if Billy Graham didn't look like he looked at the time, that he would have been the WWF champion, or he would have been as big of a star as he was? How many livers has the man gone through by now? Smaller guys wrestling for the world title is nothing new. Shawn Michaels wasn't much heavier than Kofi Kingston is. And some call him the greatest champion of all time. If Billy Graham ran WWE back in the mid-90s, we never would have had Bret Hart. We never would have had Shawn Michaels as champion. It would have been Sid for 5 straight years. It's a dated viewpoint. It is less about size, and it's more about personalities. But he's an old school guy. He was a guy who took all the steroids in the world and got all jacked up to the gills, and so he doesn't know from it. He's got one frame of reference and one point of view, and he just can't understand. I just can't understand. Why is Vince McMahon listening to the fans and giving them a challenger that they wanted? You know what's interesting about this? If Billy Graham had a say in the matter, let's go back to 2014 for a second, right? Batista came back to WWE. Oh, Batista is built in the same mold as Billy Graham. Billy Graham, he pleasures himself when he looks at Batista, right? That's exactly the kind of wrestler Billy Graham, I'm sure, loves, because he used to look like that. And those are the kind of guys he remembers from wrestling way back when. The plan when Batista came back in 2014 was to win the Royal Rumble and go on to win the championship at WrestleMania. And the people might have been okay with that were it not for Daniel Bryan getting hot when he did and not even being included in the Royal Rumble match that year. That set people off. And they said, wait a minute, we like this guy. This guy's been in the mix and in the main storyline now for the last 3 or 4 months. We thought this was building to something, and you mean to tell me the reason that Daniel Bryan is not going to WrestleMania is because you wanted to bring back this jacked up guy who hasn't wrestled in God knows how many years and just stick him in the WrestleMania main event? And the people rebelled. And to their credit, I mean, it took a lot of different circumstances, including Punk walking out, but at the end of the day, they gave the people what they wanted, and they set up this great story where Bryan had to first go through Triple H to get to the main event. He got to the main event, and to his credit, Batista had no problem not only losing to Daniel Bryan, he tapped out to a guy almost half his size. Because Batista knew that's how you do business. He didn't bitch and moan publicly about how ridiculous it was. He was an advocate for Daniel Bryan going back even years before, when Bryan was even smaller and even less of a big deal in the company. This was before Batista left the first time. I can only imagine what Billy Graham must have thought of that. What is WWE doing? Why are they taking Batista out of the picture or putting this smaller guy in there and having him beat Batista? He probably had an aneurysm. But these are examples of WWE, probably against their will, but actually doing what the fans are dictating. I thought that the wrestling business was supposed to be, at least in large part, built upon being able to listen to your audience and feel out the crowd. They can't always get everything they want, but when they get behind somebody and they get passionate about somebody, you should be able to pick up on that and capitalize on that, utilize that, make money off of that. Give the people what they want when they shout loud enough and long enough. You know, guys can be popular one week and not a big deal the next, but Daniel Bryan, man, phew, for months. For months on end, the people would go crazy. And that's kind of what we're seeing now with Kofi Kingston. So you don't have to be a Kofi Kingston fan. But this fucking idea that Kofi Kingston's 150 pounds soaking wet, this company is going to hell in a handbasket. No, the wrestling business would be going to hell in a handbasket with that viewpoint. Thank God we don't have more people these days who think like he does. So does Big E do the turn? At WrestleMania? After WrestleMania? You know, that there's been some talk about that too. Is there going to be a New Day turn? You look at his face at the end of that gauntlet in the ring when all three New Day members were in the ring celebrating and Kofi was, you know, laughing and cheering and Xavier had a smile on his face and Big E, I don't know, just this weird, not smile, but this weird look he had on his face. Maybe they are planting seeds very subtly that something like that is going to happen. You know, and look, what about Big E as a handpicked kind of corporate champion for Vince McMahon? He's not a racist. He just doesn't like Kofi. He gets behind Big E. Maybe Big E gets the championship at some point soon. Does Xavier turn with him? That's the other question. If there's a turn, if there's a split in the New Day, is it just Big E thinking these guys are dead weight, I don't need them, and he leaves them both in the dust like Rollins did with the Shield? Or does Xavier sort of go along with him and say, look, both of us, you know, we're here too. All the attention's been on Kofi. What about us? And Xavier, if he still wrestles, but almost becomes like a mouthpiece or a manager in a way for Big E. For his career, I think it would be better to turn and be a mouthpiece for Big E. Because I think if Xavier gets left behind and he stays a babyface, you know, he's the kind of guy they'll put on 205 Live. You know, I don't have a lot of faith that he would end up in a very good position if that happened. He would be kind of left out in the cold. It's interesting to think about, you know, do I expect it to happen? I don't. I don't think that that's the direction they're going in. But I will say this. If there is a turn planned, and there's a way to do it where it could end up being a really great story, I would still have Kofi win the championship. I really think it would be a huge mistake at this point to not put that title on Kofi Kingston, even if it was just a very brief thing. Maybe it's a Christian-type reign from 2011, where Christian finally, for the first time in his career, after nobody ever looked at him and thought he had a shot at being a World Heavyweight Champion outside of the ECW brand, he wins the big gold belt. He wins the World Heavyweight title, and at the taping 2 days later, he drops it to Randy Orton. I remember how bitterly furious people were. And the two of them then feuded for the next several months. Christian won the belt back for a month. But maybe it's the same thing where he wins it, and then on Tuesday on SmackDown, that's where the turn happens. And maybe they take the title off him that night. Maybe it's the next week. Who knows? I kind of feel like I'd be okay with that, because Big E is somebody that also, I think, deserves some recognition. He does a lot of goofy, silly things, and he's, you know, could be a very entertaining character in that way. But we've seen signs of it in recent weeks. There's a serious side underneath all of that. Is this guy who I think is just waiting to break out and show people, hey, you've been sleeping on me all these years. Forget about Kofi. What about me? So I'm not against the idea of some kind of a Big E turn, but not to screw Kofi out of the championship of WrestleMania. I just think that would be... I that would leave a really bad taste, I think, in a lot of people's mouths. And really sour, I think, a lot of people on this WrestleMania show. They've done a great job with this story. To me, you've got to pay the story off. And then you can go in whatever direction you want to go in. Mustafa Ali, he was out there. They had the whole roster come out and celebrate, surround the ring, bang on the mat, as New Day was in the ring celebrating at the end of all this. Now Mustafa Ali is just Ali. They've chopped off his first name too. He didn't seem too thrilled about it. He tweeted that Mustafa means the chosen one, with an emphasis on being chosen from amongst the people. Nothing has changed. I fight for the people. I am one of them. I'm starting to think that Vince McMahon in his old age just can't remember people's names anymore. So to make it easier, he's shortening everybody's name. But like Andrade Cien Almas, it does not change the fact that I'm going to continue to refer to him on this show as Mustafa Ali. So that does not change. There was a post-show interview up on YouTube. I would encourage you all, it's about 5 minutes long. It's just New Day in the back, right after coming through the curtain, standing around, and it's probably the most real interview or segment like this with them that I've seen throughout this whole thing. I mean, it's mixing, you know, kayfabe with real stuff, but you could see they're speaking like normal people. They're expressing some very real emotions. They're speaking a lot of truth. It just was legit, pure emotion. And the greatest stories, I said this, the greatest stories are the ones that just sneak up on you when you least expect it. 2 months ago, 3 months ago, who would have expected that anybody was going to be excited to see Kofi Kingston, or that Kofi Kingston would even be challenging for the WWE title at WrestleMania? Who would have predicted that? If anybody says they would have predicted that, they're a liar. But I have to say this. As much as I love the end of SmackDown, and I have turned into a big fan of the whole angle and everything, they still took the cheap way out to explain why Vince McMahon does not want Kofi Kingston in the main event of WrestleMania challenging for the championship. For weeks now, he has said that Kofi is a B-plus player, pal. Calls him a B-plus player. You're not box office. This was his rationale for not wanting Kofi to challenge for the title. And they have copped out on giving us a real explanation as to why. So now, let me get this straight. Kofi's friends win a match, and now Vince McMahon is okay with giving Kofi Kingston a title opportunity at WrestleMania. Not before, when Kofi had to fight for an hour in a gauntlet of his own to earn the right to go to WrestleMania, which he did before he got fucked at the end. That didn't convince Vince McMahon that Kofi deserves a match. No, his friends wrestling for him while he stood in the back and watched on TV. That suddenly somehow convinced Vince McMahon, hey, this Kofi Kingston guy, he deserves a WWE title match at WrestleMania. What? What sense does that make? That makes no sense. Unless, the idea is that Vince McMahon has already handpicked his champion in Big E, and the turn does happen at WrestleMania. But still, that's the one big critique I have about all of this, is the lack of a story when it comes to why Vince would be so adamantly against this man wrestling for the title. It's cheap and it's lazy. There were multiple sad tweet contenders this week. Too many to name all of them. In response to the news of Rob Gronkowski retiring from the NFL, Dash Wilder of The Revival, one half of your Raw Tag Team Champions, by the way, who, by all accounts, The Revival are still probably very much looking to the exits at the end of their contract next year, he tweeted, "We'll probably face Gronkowski and Mojo at WrestleMania." You know what? They should hope to wrestle Mojo and Gronk at WrestleMania. At least then they'd be on the card. And that'd be a pretty high-profile spot for them, too. To which Mickey James responded, "Well, better than not working WrestleMania, I suppose." Clearly, some frustration there from Mickey James. Somebody also separately tweeted Dolph Ziggler, "What are your plans for WrestleMania?" His response, "Buying a ticket, just like Zack Ryder." After WWE tweeted out a tribute video for Women's History Month, featuring various clips of women's wrestlers, Maria Kanellis tweeted back at the main WWE account, saying, "Great video. I think you forgot me. I'm on 205 Live, which is part of the main roster. Oh, and I've been in the company a total of 7.5 years, but that's cool. 15.5 years total in this business. Maybe watch a few other places' highlight reels. They don't forget me." Boy, morale in that company just looks peachy right now, doesn't it? What a fun place that must be to work these days. But they weren't the only ones. Eric Bischoff and Jim Cornette got into a Twitter war this week. I don't know how it started. Probably some fool made a comment to try to instigate things. That's usually how these things start. Whatever it was, the coward deleted his original tweet. But Bischoff took the bait, and he said, "Jim is a tortured soul, S-O-L-E, who is only able to survive as a trust fund baby that lives off the success his mommy and daddy created, and still gets his rocks off living off of his 8 minutes of fame." Yes, Eric Bischoff hurled the worst insult that you could possibly throw at another human being. He called him the bottom of a foot. The tortured bottom of a foot at that. Either that or he was calling him a fish. Cornette responded in typical Cornette fashion. Then Bischoff was going on about how Cornette only drew 100 people while, you know, we drew 300 people at our podcast thing. Basically, my dick is bigger than your dick. They're all dicks. At the end of the day, it's like when these arguments take place, it's not a matter of my dick is bigger than your dick. You're all dicks. Back and forth they went. It's all quite sad, really. But nothing sadder than calling somebody the bottom of a foot. Unless you call somebody a Gurkamanakin, which is a Scandinavian insult that Betty White's character on The Golden Girls once used on somebody, which describes the precise moment that dog dew turns white. That's probably worse. I don't even know if that's true or if that was a made-up word for the show. I assume it was made up. Maybe one of my Scandinavian friends can chime in and let me know. But the next time somebody tells me to stop pushing Matt Riddle so hard in my NXT reviews, I'm calling them a Gurkamanakin.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
NXT this week, this was the second to last show before TakeOver. Johnny Gargano, Adam Cole had a long back and forth promo at the start of the show to hype up their NXT title match coming up at TakeOver. Matt Riddle beat Kona Reeves, despite the distraction from the Velveteen Dream being rolled out in the middle of this match, onto the stage, lying on a couch, surrounded by ladies, with a drink in hand. He was drinking from some kind of goblet, some kind of weird cup. Riddle, after he won, walked right up to him on stage, took the cup out of his hand, drank from it, flung it behind him, and said, "I'll see you in New York City, bro." We then had the finals of the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, the Forgotten Sons, hopefully soon to be Fresh Afternoon, throwing out waffles on SmackDown, against Ricochet and Aleister Black. Match was good. It was good. Not the kind of blowaway match you would hope for in the finals. Definitely not the kind of match we would have gotten if it would have been Mustache Mountain going to the finals. I could promise you that. Jackson Ryker got tossed by the referee for trying to interfere late in the match. Black Mass to Wesley Blake. Ricochet with the 630 for the pin. They had a face-off with the War Raiders to end the show and a little preview of their tag team title match coming up at TakeOver. Speaking of TakeOver, let's get to the rundown for the show this coming Friday night at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Remember, I'm hosting our meetup at the King's Beer Hall Friday at 2 p.m., a few blocks away from the Barclays Center. It's a few hours before the NXT show, and around 6 o'clock or so, I'm going to be walking over to the Barclays Center. So hopefully you can stop by, even if it's just for a few minutes, and join us for a drink. Or if you don't, you know, drink and you want to bring the family, bring your kids. I mean, at least until 5 o'clock. I don't know about after 5, but I know up until 5, families are usually welcome. And there's food and there's games. They have games there as well, pool table. So hopefully I'll be able to see a lot of you guys there. Pete Dunne defends his WWE United Kingdom Championship against Walter. Nearly 2 years as UK champion for Pete Dunne. They have this international superstar draft coming up next month in a few weeks. I think he's earned the right to be part of it. I think Walter is going to be the perfect sort of monster champion to dominate the title picture on that UK show for a while. There's nothing left for Pete Dunne to do with that belt. I think he finally drops it here. I'm picking Walter to win. We have the War Raiders defending the NXT Tag Team titles against Aleister Black and Ricochet, winners of the 2019 Dusty Cup. Aleister Black and Ricochet, they're going to Raw and SmackDown. There's no reason for them to win the Tag Team titles here. So I think the War Raiders retain, especially if I think, we'll see if they announce the match this week, but if they announce a Tag Team title match for the Raw belts at WrestleMania, I think Black and Ricochet are going to win Tag Team gold, but it's going to be at WrestleMania, not at TakeOver. Matt Riddle challenges for his very first title in NXT, the North American Championship against the Velveteen Dream. I'm picking Matt Riddle to win the title here. I think he stays undefeated. I really do. I think he stays undefeated, and I think there may be a main roster call-up in the Dream's not-too-distant future. Shayna Baszler defends her NXT Women's Championship in a fatal four-way against Kairi Sane, Io Shirai, and Bianca Belair. It's been pointed out online that there are ladders visible in the match graphic for the women's match at TakeOver. I don't know that it's there for the other matches. This could end up this week becoming a ladder match, a four-way ladder match for the NXT Women's title. So we'll see. The rules of this match are such that, you know, the champion does not have to be pinned or beaten. If it is a pinfall match, they don't have to be beaten to win or to lose, rather, their championship. It's the perfect way to take the title off of Shayna Baszler without having to make her look weak or tap out to somebody or something like that. Because of that, and because I think she's probably overdue for a call-up, I am going to pick Io Shirai. I think Io Shirai wins her very first NXT Women's title, and that could make things very interesting between her and the former champion, her best friend, Kairi Sane. And with Tommaso Ciampa sidelined for the rest of the year, after neck surgery, the NXT Championship is now vacant. We are guaranteed a new NXT champion when Johnny Gargano meets Adam Cole in a 2 out of 3 falls match. You know, with Ciampa going down to injury, I think Gargano's stay in NXT is going to be extended for the foreseeable future. And I don't feel sorry for him. I actually think it's probably for the best in his case. It probably will turn out to be a blessing if he doesn't get rushed to the main roster right now by himself, because I don't know what you do with him. I mean, I know what I would do. I'd probably put him on SmackDown. I have a few guys in mind I'd like to see him get in the ring with. But that's not what Vince McMahon would do with him, and so NXT probably is the best place for him right now. I think they finally decide to pay off his journey to the title with a big win in Brooklyn. I still think Johnny Gargano is going to walk out with the NXT Championship at the end of the show. So that's the rundown of the matches. I think there's also a very good chance, you know, they usually have some new signee. They show them in the crowd. They're waving to the crowd. I think it'll be Kushida this time. We have not heard much about him since he left New Japan. He had that final match against Tanahashi, that big send-off. I think we'll see him at the Barclays Center on Friday night. They've done a very good job of hiding him. Although he has been seen lately at the Performance Center, they did not include him, for example, in the big group photo that they took of their latest class of recruits several weeks ago. But I do think there's a very good chance we'll see him on Friday night. So these takeover cards are never bad. Some are better than others, but I've never, ever seen a bad takeover show. And I think the real competition this weekend is going to be between the show on Friday and the MSG show on Saturday. Now, I was going to talk about the Kenny Omega documentary that I watched, the big TSN documentary that was rumored for HBO Canada a number of months ago. It did air. Somebody sent me a link. Don't ask me for it because the link is no longer active. But I did watch it. I don't have time to get into it, though. We've got to get right into the WrestleMania countdown stuff. We've gone too long here. I got to get out of here. But I will hopefully on the next show or one of the upcoming shows take a few minutes just to talk about it and give my thoughts on it. Maybe by then it'll be more widely available online and you guys can have a chance to watch it as well. I do want to mention this, though. This one email. I got an email from Roy. I won't say from where because I don't know if he wants me to on the air, but he shared a photo with me of his Be The Match donor card, donor registration card for bone marrow donations. He said, I didn't even realize something like this existed until I heard your podcast a few months ago where you shared one listener's story about becoming a donor. It really made an impact on me and inspired me to do the same. I just thought you'd like to know that it was all because of you and your show that I even found out about this. That's awesome, and I thank Roy for that, and I'm glad that you sent me that email. He sent me the photo of the card and everything. That's awesome. I mention this here, not just because it's a cool story, but I mention this because the timing could not be better. Close friend of mine teaches elementary school kids, one of her former students. It's a 10-year-old girl named Khadija. She is in the 5th grade. She was diagnosed with chronic kidney failure last year, and she is in need of a donor kidney. Her parents were not a good match. They were tested. They weren't a good match. She says after she gets her transplant, she's going to go to Disneyland for a week. I mean, don't we all want to go to Disneyland? I ask only that you please visit her page on the National Kidney Registry and you can read her story in her own words and find out if you are eligible to possibly donate a kidney, not just to her, but to anybody. You can go, if not you, maybe it's someone you know. Maybe you could share the link with your friends and family, people on Facebook, spread it around. It would be tremendous. The website address to visit is nkr.org/CEN498. So that's nkr.org/CEN, like John Cena without the A, 498. You can read her story, see her picture there, and again, you can look into more information about what's involved in possibly making a donation or getting tested to be donated, to donate a kidney. It could save a life. And I know there are people out there who are all about these sorts of things, and maybe you're already on the registry, maybe you've already done this before, but anything you could do would be tremendous. She's on dialysis. I know that her need level is considered immediate. We're hoping that somebody will come through for her, but whether it's for her or somebody else, just go to that link and look into kidney donation, because you could potentially save a life. And that's bigger than any wrestling stuff we could talk about here.
What did we just see? What did we just see? It's WrestleMania, baby!
Top 10 most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes. We've only got two more left. We are in the home stretch. And number two in our countdown takes us back to probably the greatest top-to-bottom WrestleMania of all time, WrestleMania 17, from the Astrodome in Houston, Texas, April 1st, 2001. Stone Cold Steve Austin back in Texas, back home in the great state of Texas, challenging for the WWF title against his second greatest rival, second only to Vince McMahon, and that is The Rock. So what makes this the greatest WrestleMania of all time? It was the culmination, in a lot of ways, the climax, the peak, of the Attitude Era. The most popular era in the history of the company. You want drama? This show had drama. You want action? This show had action. You want great matches? This show had some of those too. You want comic relief and nostalgia? They gave that to you in the gimmick Battle Royal. Maybe the best, worst match I've ever seen. Right down to the commentary from Mean Gene Okerlund and Bobby the Brain Heenan. This was also the only WrestleMania to ever have commentary from the team of Jim Ross and Paul Heyman. This was right after Jerry Lawler had quit in protest of them releasing his wife, the Cat. JR and Heyman were a great pair. It had the first meeting on pay-per-view ever between Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. The start of that great feud. It had, in my opinion, still to this day, the greatest TLC match of all the ones they've ever done, TLC 2, with Edge and Christian, the Hardys, and the Dudleys, and that incredible midair spear from Edge to Jeff Hardy. There was a fun street fight between Vince McMahon and Shane McMahon, that great moment where Zombie Linda McMahon, rises from her chair to kick her husband in the dick, which, you know, you laugh, but this got a bigger reaction than almost anyone on the current roster, anything that they've done in the last 12 months, because they told a story. And they paid it off here in a way that people wanted to see it get paid off for weeks. Linda was in a comatose state sitting in a wheelchair while her husband made out and swapped spit with Trish Stratus. Lucky guy, right? And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and how he just completely disrespected his wife right in front of her face. This was after, I think, he had asked her for a divorce. I think this was after he asked her for a divorce, unless that came later on, but maybe that did come later. But it all built up to this one great moment where he physically put his wife in a chair in the corner of the ring and said, "Watch this, I'm going to kick our son's ass." And as soon as he turned his back, Linda rose up, and you could see they had that wide shot of the crowd. And everybody stood up, and Vince turned around, spread his legs out, and then boom! And the place just, you would think Hogan slammed Andre again. The place went nuts. It was such a great moment. We also had Undertaker against Triple H. This is their forgotten WrestleMania match, but also, I think, maybe their best one. This might still be my favorite of all the WrestleMania matches, the three, that these guys had. I think it's between this and the one from 27. I was not much of a fan as some of you were of that Hell in a Cell, End of an Era stuff at 28. I was there for that. It was my first WrestleMania in person. It was good, but yeah, not as good as these other matches the two of them had. I love that sledgehammer tease where Undertaker had him up for the last ride, even though there was a 10-minute ref bump. Referee was down for about 10 minutes off one bump. But he had him up for the last ride, and Triple H had grabbed the sledgehammer before he got hoisted up. And so he lifted up the sledgehammer, and boom, right down into the head of the Undertaker, knocked him out. Did the slow crawl. The referee had to do the slow crawl to count. It was just a near fall. It was just great. Great moment. Great match. And then there's the main event. The second such WrestleMania main event between Stone Cold and The Rock. You know, going back and watching this, the video and the match itself, I really don't think that it can... I hate to be a Debbie Downer here, but I really don't think it could ever be as good wrestling again as it was here. It just can't be. Not the way they do things now. I mean, we're talking WWE. We're not talking all the other wrestling out there. It can't be that way ever again. Wrestling can still be fun, but it can never be what it was back then in WWE during that era. It was a different business. It was a different company. The company's a lot bigger now. They have sponsors to answer to. And just the way they do things, the way they write television, the way they book television, the formula, everything is so different now in a lot of ways than it was back then. It's like BC and AD when you look at the two different eras. And I feel bad for the newer fans who don't know of those times and think the way it is now is how it's always been. This is great. I mean, I'm glad they enjoyed themselves. But, you know, even going to the network and watching all of the old shows, if you just kind of bring them up on the WWE Network, it's not the same. If you didn't live through it, you had to have lived through it to truly appreciate it. So we had this Austin-Rock rivalry that had been built up now for a number of years, one of the greatest of all time. I said before, you know, Rock is second only to Vince McMahon as Austin's greatest foe. For years, Vince McMahon would try to make Stone Cold's life a living hell. The success that this company enjoyed in the late 90s was largely built on the back of Austin versus McMahon. Austin was the perfect foil for Vince McMahon. I mean, who among us doesn't have the urge sometimes, at least, to go beat up your boss, right? That's how that whole feud, that's what it was predicated on. People were living through Austin every week. They got a kick out of watching him come out and kick Vince in the nuts or jump off a Zamboni or hose him down in beer. All the different things that this guy gets boss arrested and pour beer on his head. All the different things that he did to this guy. It was, you never knew from one week to the next what you were going to get. It was fun. It was unpredictable. And they just struck gold between the two of them. But the idea that Austin and Vince McMahon could be friends, it just didn't feel right to even think about it. There were moments like that over the years where Vince would go babyface for a while, but, you know, in the end, he'd end up screwing over Austin anyway. But then in 99, Austin had to go have neck surgery done. His neck injury caught up with him, going back to the pile driver from Owen Hart. He was never really the same after that. He had to change his whole style, the way he wrestled, the bumps that he took and the bumps that he didn't take. It all caught up with him. And he had to go have neck surgery. He was out for almost a year. Really, he only missed about 9 or 10 months. But after that, the protocol for that surgery seemed to be, you will not be cleared anywhere before 12 months. And maybe that was because Austin came back. Maybe he had some lingering issues and they learned from that. I don't know. But he was gone almost a year. And Austin was the biggest star, not just in the company, but in the wrestling business at that time. This was the top of the line guy. This would be like Hogan going down with neck surgery in 86. That's how big of a deal this was. Thankfully for WWE, they had a backup plan. They had done a good job of building up more than just Austin. They were very fortunate to have an Austin and a Rock at the same exact time. Who has that? What would be the Austin-Rock combo right now in WWE? There is none. They don't exist. They had the luxury of having these two ultra-popular babyfaces. So when one went down, the other could kind of fill the role and pick up the slack. And they had Triple H, who they had started building, you know, a year earlier, basically, or more than a year earlier, as a top heel in the company. And in the year 2000, it was Rock and Triple H, largely, who carried that company on their backs and were the featured top performers. And they were fortunate that they had a great supporting cast there to help them. It wasn't just Rock and Triple H. You had Undertaker, Kurt Angle, Rikishi and Too Cool. You know, they had a lot of very popular acts in the company at that time. They were very fortunate. The Radicals came in from WCW. That helped. But in the time that you know, he was away, Austin did make an appearance. He helped Rock win the title of Backlash in 2000. He shared a beer with him at the end of that match. And I remember even then there were rumors that maybe Austin might turn on Rock, watch Stone Cold, let's see what happens here. And I kind of expected him when he was, you know, doing the whole cheers thing with Rock and the beer that he was going to kick him in the gut and give him a stunner. Although I think with his neck in the state that it was in, he was only 3 or 4 months into his recovery. This was when he walked out and everybody said, oh, Stone Cold got fat. Yeah, he got fat because he just had neck surgery, you freaking knuckle-dragging fool. Like, what do you expect him to do? Be lifting 100-pound weights at the gym? So I don't think he could even hit a stunner. He mowed down 6 people with a steel chair, couldn't even hit a stunner. But that was really the only time we saw him before he came back later on that fall. And then we had Austin's comeback story, right? He went after the guy who was responsible for running him down, first Rikishi and then Triple H, and then came the Royal Rumble. And he won his third Royal Rumble match, the first and still only to this day person to do that. Rock, in the meantime, at the No Way Out pay-per-view in February, beat Kurt Angle to win back the WWF title that Kurt had beaten him 4 months earlier. And on that same show, Austin, who's already punched his ticket to WrestleMania, he lost a 3 Stages of Hell match to Triple H. And poor Austin got hit in the head with a beer can when the match was over. If you go back and watch, these guys are laying on top of each other, just dead. The match is over. All of a sudden, you see this can come flying in. I don't know who threw this can, but this person had just perfect aim. And it hit Austin right in the head. And you could see Austin just flinched and knocked Triple H off of him. I think Austin even has talked about this before and said that it hurt like a bitch. But he lost. He lost that match to Triple H. Vince McMahon, in the weeks leading up to WrestleMania, trying to find every way to fuck the two of these guys over and turn them against each other, and he put Austin's wife, Deborah, with The Rock as The Rock's manager. So now it's the second-to-last SmackDown before WrestleMania. It's the sit-down interview backstage with Jim Ross interviewing The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin. I need to beat you, Rock. I need more than anything that you could ever imagine. Those were Austin's words. The seeds were being planted. Then we had one of the greatest video build-up packages that this company has ever done. That was the video that was set to My Way by Limp Bizkit. Even if you don't like Limp Bizkit, you have to admit, that song was pitch perfect for that video. Then we get to WrestleMania, the match itself. Going back again and watching it, it's an epic match. I mean, it really is everything you would want in a WrestleMania main event. And I was never the biggest fan of it. When I was comparing it to like some of their other matches, I actually once said on the show, and I think people wanted to take my head off for it, that I liked their WrestleMania 15 match maybe even better than their WrestleMania 17 match, and might rank it above the WrestleMania 17 match. Now, I still like that match too. I go back though and I watch this, and it would be hard to rank anything above this, because this really, in a lot of ways, this was just the total package of what you would want to see out of a true WrestleMania main event. 2 biggest names, 70,000 people, titles on the line, 2 babyfaces no less, although Rock wasn't much of one in Texas. This poor guy had back-to-back WrestleMania matches as a babyface where he was booed out of the building like a heel. Through no fault of his own. But this was a war. That's what this match was. This match was a fucking war. And you could see, as the match went on, Austin just slowly descending into madness a little bit more each time. Every time Rock would kick out from a stunner, he would kick out from some other big move or a chair shot or something, because it was, you know, no DQ. Austin would just slip a little bit more into madness. And that was the story they were telling. Austin said it himself. He needed to beat The Rock. He had to beat The Rock. There could be no other option here. Austin was losing his mind. He was desperate. He even busted out his old million-dollar dream that he learned from Ted DiBiase. Dipping back into his old bag of tricks, doing everything he can to put Rock away, but nothing would work. And then down to the ring came Vince McMahon, sore testicles and all from what happened earlier in the night, sliding Austin a chair. What the hell's going on here? Why is he helping Stone Cold? More importantly, why is Austin accepting his help? And then we get to the whole finish where Austin is hitting Rock with a chair, Rock kicks out. Hits him with a chair, Rock kicks out. Finally, Austin just loses his shit. He obliterates The Rock, beats this guy to a bloody pulp with that chair about 10 times in a row, rolls him over, and pins him. And just like that, Austin is the champion, and the people sure didn't react like he was a heel. They exploded for the win. Remember, they are in Texas. Austin starts he's shaking hands with Satan himself. That was the legendary line from Jim Ross, one of many legendary lines that you can credit to Jim Ross. And his, by the way, his WWE contract just expired this week. He's likely on his way to All Elite Wrestling. But I think we should take a moment here and acknowledge the fact that the man spent 26 years of his life working for Vince McMahon, which can't be easy. Right? He may not be the Jim Ross of old anymore. He definitely isn't. But he is the greatest of all time. When it comes to play-by-play announcing in pro wrestling, there's nobody better than Jim Ross. And it's shocking turns and twists like this, I think, where he shined the most. Especially when Vince McMahon or somebody was screwing over somebody else. The way that JR would just lose his mind and lose his shit was great. And it really sold the story. It made it feel real. This guy was invested. It was like he was personally offended by what he was watching. You don't get that today. You really don't get that anymore. But the turn was shocking. They dropped all sorts of little hints, including adding the no disqualification stipulation, literally as the match was about to begin. Even Jim Ross was like, wait, no DQ. What's that about? That should have been a sign. But it was still shocking when it happened. This one moment, this one handshake, marked the end of the Attitude Era. It marked the end of everything that Stone Cold character represented. I remember hating it when it happened. But it did give us a lot of great comedic moments with Austin and Kurt Angle, or the time that Austin got thrown through a window on SmackDown backstage by The Undertaker. They strapped Austin to a gurney. He's got a big white bandage over his eye. And he just, as Vince and Triple H, I think, were there with him, they're wheeling him off, and he just keeps shouting, "My eye!" He goes, I didn't do nothing to that man, Vince. I don't know what his problem is. I didn't do nothing to that man. It was great. I enjoyed that. But turning Stone Cold was one of the worst decisions that that company ever made. Austin himself says that he regrets he ever did it, and it was his idea. He thought he was flatlining a little bit as a babyface, getting a little stale. And he wanted to try something different. He was a heel at heart. He never wanted to be a babyface in the first place. But people just did not want to hate him. And by the end of the year, he was already back to being a babyface. Even before December, he was back to being a babyface. He says it is the worst call that he has ever made outside of refusing to job to Brock Lesnar on Raw the day that he took his ball and went home. He said he wishes he never did it. And instead, when he went to go shake Vince's hand, he would have kicked him and given him a stunner. He even thought about doing it. He thought about calling an audible and just doing it, and he didn't. Business-wise, this is where things began to decline. You could trace it right back to this heel turn. The ratings started to go down. There were certain other business indicators, I think, when it comes to tickets and pay-per-view that were not as strong as they were previously. You can track the decline back to this moment here. And I think also, you have to include the death of WCW, which happened around the exact same time. WCW was, you know, near its end anyway, at the end of its rope. But it still drew an audience every week, and they were still doing some business. And when WCW died, I mean, bigger than any heel turn, the worst thing that ever happened to wrestling was the death of WCW. But the combination of that and the Austin heel turn happening around the same time, that's what did business in. And business started to go down. They would kill today to get the kind of numbers ratings-wise they were doing then. But even still, things started to go down, and it was because of this. I mean, they turned Austin in Texas, knowing full well that Rock was leaving to go film a movie. And they had no other babyfaces on top for him to feud with other than Kane and The Undertaker. That was it. Triple H was apparently going to turn. They were going to turn him babyface. It made sense for him to do so because, remember, he had that win at No Way Out in the Three Stages of Hell over Austin. He had the perfect case to make for wanting the next shot at the championship. He could have turned, and he decided he didn't want to. He wanted to team with Stone Cold. Very savvy move on his part. Because, you know, he had to know that he wasn't taking the title away from Austin. Austin just won it. After a few months and losing to Austin, they'd move on to somebody else. Then what happens to me? What happens to Triple H? Better to team with the guy and glom some of that heat off of him. And then, finally, a few months later, when it started to look like maybe they were going in the direction of a split between the two, you know, the two-man power trip, Triple H tore his quad. And he was gone for 9 months. Here's the other reason, though, before I wrap this up, that I hated this heel turn. Heel Stone Cold in 2001 also spawned the single worst chant in the history of the business. One that continues to infect WWE shows to this very day. And that is the what chant. The what chant was a blight on pro wrestling. And people had a lot of fun saying it back then when it was still kind of sort of relevant, which it hasn't been in about 15 fucking years. They chanted what after everything Austin said. They chanted what after everything everybody said. It spread like a virus. But you would think after a few years, Austin's gone, the man's retired. They still kept doing it. So now every person who goes out there has to pass the what test. How do you react when people start whatting you? People, I guess there are still people out there who still get a kick out of it. There are people out there who get a kick out of kicking puppies, too. But that doesn't make it right. I hate that fucking what chant with every fiber of my being and wish it would die in a fire. And here we are, almost 20 years later. It's not as bad as it used to be, where it's every promo every week. It is kind of, I feel like, dying down finally. But it took this long. And it's still around. Probably, you know what, I'll say this. It is the single worst contribution that Stone Cold Steve Austin ever made to the wrestling business. For all the good that this guy did, as big of a draw as he was, as much money as he made everybody, including himself, his single worst contribution to wrestling is that stupid chant. Another reason to hate the Stone Cold heel turn from 2001, which was a shocking WrestleMania match outcome. And on episode 593 later this week, I will reveal the number one most shocking WrestleMania match outcome here on this countdown, and we'll wrap this list up. It's been fun going through this, so I think we'll give them a break for a while, and then at some point we'll come back with a different countdown. But that's coming up on the next podcast. That's it for this week. I am pooped. I have a lot to do here. I'll let you guys go too, and don't forget, we are having our meetup on Friday, 2 p.m., at the King's Beer Hall in Brooklyn, just a few blocks away from the Barclay Center. I expect to see you there. And if you are attending any or all of the other events going on WrestleMania weekend, hopefully I'll bump into you at some of them. And hopefully you'll have fun and enjoy yourself. And I'm going to be doing a gazillion different things as well. Like I said, my plan right now is to get the next sound off up late Thursday, early Friday. And that will be almost exclusively WrestleMania predictions. Number one in the WrestleMania countdown that I just was talking about. If I have time, maybe I could also talk a little bit about that Kenny Omega documentary. And that's going to be it. It's not going to be a regular full show. There is no roundtable this year because we just couldn't coordinate. There's just so much going on. So you got me. Sorry. You just have to deal with me, I guess. I am planning on being at the House of Glory show on Saturday. They're having a matinee in the middle of the day out in Queens. And hopefully calling some of the matches on that show. Great Muda is wrestling on that show. A lot of names are going to be wrestling on that HOG show. And so that should be a lot of fun. And then straight from there, I come from Queens into the city. We've got the Madison Square Garden show. I know also that night, for those of you who are a fan of the Wrestling Soup Boys, they're having their own meetup event at Lucky 13 Saloon in Brooklyn at 11 o'clock and going live, I think, at midnight with a midnight podcast. So definitely support Mish and Draper and the whole gang there and Joey. That should be a lot of fun. Sunday is WrestleMania. I don't even know what I'm doing. I think I'm going to a tailgate, actually, somewhere in the parking lot at MetLife Stadium. And then we've got 17 hours of WrestleMania. I will hopefully have time on Monday to first sit down and record a review that will be going up on the YouTube channel. And then I have to get ready to go out on Monday night for Monday Night Raw. And then I'm done. I'm not going to SmackDown. I'm not going anywhere else. I'm going home. And I'm going to sleep for a week. That's my plan. But anyway, so that's all I got. Enjoy the week. It's going to be crazy. I will see you for episode 593. Until then, be well, stay safe, and hope to see you all at the KBH on Friday at 2 p.m. Take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Harlem Heat 2000, Techno Team 2000, LOD 2000, WrestleMania 2000. Anything as a rule of thumb with 2000 in the name, you know it sucked.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and coming soon, Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.